All right, now it's on.
Okay. Let's call to order the regular meeting and public hearing of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, September 8th, 2016. First item is to approve tonight's agenda. Being that I'm looking at our public attendance, I would like to know if the Planning Commission would be willing to move item number 7 up to item number 4 and move the rest of the items down. Is there any objection?
I support that.
Okay, hearing none, so we'll move item number 7 to position number 4, and number 4 will come 5 and 5, 6 and 6, 7. All those in favor of tonight's agenda say aye.
Aye.
The agenda is approved. Next item on the agenda is the approval of minutes for August 25th, 2016. Do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Motion by Commissioner Leckie and a second. Second by Commissioner Miller. Comments or changes? Mr. Bryant.
The on the second page of the item number 5. The motion was approved 3-1. I dissent on that page.
Okay. Any other comments or changes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved unanimously. Quick question on the comments in our minutes. You talked about having the fire department come in and talk to us about FireWise, given that this item is approved. Is that still going to be something that we'll have?
I think there was an interest from Mr. Ryan to have them come in and talk just in general as it applies to potentially North Bend or their fire area.
Okay. So it's still okay. Great. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is public comment on non-agenda items. Does anybody from the public wish to comment on something that is not on tonight's agenda? Seeing none, we'll move over to item number 4, which is the introduction to amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 18.10.030 to allow RV parks in the IC zone and amendments to 18.10.050 providing additional performance standards concerning RV parks. Turn over to staff, whoever is going to give us the introduction.
I will be staff. Right. So this started back probably about a year ago. We started meeting with the Mountain Center Greenway, Department of Natural Resources, City of Snoqualmie, and a number of other jurisdictions and organizations about what are we doing for planning as the Middle Fork is developed with recreational interests to also plan within our cities to accommodate that tourism and the impacts and the benefits that will have for the city. And one of the things that was identified through that process is we have a lot of backcountry recreation far up the Middle Fork, but we don't have more of that front country interface. And one of the things that was identified with that would be the need for closer in camping and particularly RV parks. That's a recreational use that can support local tourism and also provide access to that Middle Fork for a different recreationalist than what's kind of further up the valley. So that kind of stewed, and we thought about it, but didn't really take action on it. And then Charles Jackson, who's here tonight, approached us about a potential developer of, or interested in developing a property within the interchange commercial zone out there at exit 34 for an RV park. And currently our code does not allow recreational vehicle parks in the interchange commercial zone. So thinking about that with the interest that we've had earlier through our interagency process, we thought, well, this is probably just the time to address this and bring forward a code amendment to see what the Planning Commission and the public thought about this.
Okay.
So what you see is the first part of the amendment is just a very simple change to 18.10.030 to add a P for RV parks in the interchange commercial zone. And then the second part of the amendment is our performance standards. When we were doing this, we thought, well, we need to reconsider our performance standards that provide more criteria for how an RV park is developed. So when we looked at that, we felt there were some amendments that we needed to address. We increased the distance between recreational vehicle paths, and I'm on page 5 of the staff report. Currently, it's 12 feet between RV paths, and that's really not sufficient if you're providing a tree in between each of the paths. With the way the RVs are developed these days, they all have the bump outs. So you get a bump out that's going 5 feet out on one side, bump out on 5 feet on the other side, and that leaves you 2 feet for that tree. So the amendment there increases that to a minimum of 15 feet, and then also stipulates that there's some larger separations, approximately every 4 RV paths to get, so that's not just kind of one in a row next to the other. We also looked at the maximum length of stay, and currently the provision is 180 days. We don't want RV parks, we want them to stay recreational and not residential. So we've proposed reducing that to a 90-day period, which allows somebody to come up for the season. For example, grandparents come up, they want to spend the summer in the Northwest, visit the kids, do some recreation. But it's not setting up a fairly permanent residence. Also wanted to beef up some of our standards regarding the existing significant trees, particularly in this area where it's the gateway to the Middle Fork. We wanted to ensure that an RV park, if developed in this area, would retain those significant trees to preserve the forested character, which is both important for the Mountain Sound Greenway, the scenic I-90 scenic corridor, and then also that entry to the Middle Fork. So we've added E and F there, addressing that those provisions. And then under G, that's just to provide a little bit more flexibility, that RV pads may be graveled. That's much more typical, that they don't have to be paved. Otherwise, our code in 18.16 would otherwise require all vehicle use areas to be paved. So with that,
just turn that last portion again. So the property owner decides not to pave, and we set that up as a preference?
It's an allowance.
Okay.
Right now, our code says all vehicle use areas have to be paved. So this is then stipulating that the pad themselves, so that the pull through,
right,
can be more like a campground type of setting.
Okay.
Your drive aisles are still going to have to be paved.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
Mike, just so the Planning Commission is clear, it's an interchange commercial, which is the purple on the map over
Yes.
there?
Yes, yeah. So interchange commercial, both purple areas, you can see exit 34 and exit 31. I thought about, should we do this specific to exit 34? But to keep it simple, the market reality is you're not going to see an RV park at exit 31 just because of highest and best uses and what's the developed context out there already. So just to keep it simple, we just said interchange commercials on the period.
Okay. So with that, anybody from the public wish to comment?
I have one.
Please
comment.
State your name and address for the record.
Jackson, 12815 Northeast 126 Place, Kirkland, Washington, 98034. One thing I'd like to add to the code is that they now have little baby RVs that are about 8 feet wide, anywhere from 18 to 30 feet long, that you can park on these pads, that we would like to park on the pads and rent them out as hotel rooms. So people can come up, they don't have to bring an RV, they can bring a car, they can go skiing whenever they want to, they have a place to stay that is their home. And it's fully functional, and we'd like to be able to allow maybe up to a third of the park to have those units in it. So it's still, you know, they're not staying with Renamont Airbnb or something like that. So they're just coming in. Enjoy the outdoors.
Those are very convenient for drivers who are parked on the freeway. Just turn the engines on. Down
business. Yes. Because they're only, because of the code, because they're RV rated, They're less than 250 feet, so they don't take up a lot of room.
They're defined by state definition as a park model RV, which are typically 15 feet in width and no more than 35 feet in length.
Yes.
And they are a recreational vehicle by state definition, and they're governed by the Department of Labor and Industries.
Yes. But here's the thing. I didn't want to have to move this thing every 90 days. So, you know, if we're going to put it there, it's going to be permanently put in this particular path.
Anything further?
That was the only thing I can think of change that I would recommend to the amendment.
Okay. Sorry. So I'm going to open up to the Planning Commission with any thoughts or comments or questions for staff. Who would like to go first?
I've got a question for the member of the public.
Okay.
Okay.
So I remember, and have done it many times recently, pull the bike in, my motorcycle, into KOA or any campgrounds that are all over the place. And if the weather's crappy, and I don't want to put my tent in the dark, I'll rent a little cabin. Many of those places have them. Is that sort of the same thing you're thinking of?
Yeah, well, we're just going to have a little house that sits there. Okay. So they can, you've had a bike, you can pull in, rent it.
Park model RV. It's a park model RV.
I actually was at the Planning Commission meeting and was down in Seaside, Oregon, staying in one of these units that, from outside, it's really attractive. It looks like a little miniature cabin. So, but the question is, how does it work? Because our concern to make sure. So from a code perspective, if you have something that stays there basically all the time, mm-hmm. how do you deal with not having someone just rent it and live in it 365 days a year?
Mm-hmm. Right now, the code just says maximum length of stay. So what we have to do is interpret, does that mean for the vehicle itself, or does that mean for the occupants? And it would have to be implemented through some kind of policy required of the RV park itself, that they'd have to implement it. We're not going to be out there with our code enforcement folks saying, how long have you been staying here?
Well, if we know we're limited to 90 days, you know, we'll just, hey, you know, you can stay here 90 days. After that, you got to go.
I think we should be clear, though, whether the city's planning commission is recommending an RV park that allows the RV to remain and the occupants to come and go, or the RV to come with the owner and come and go.
So I guess I'm kind of interested to understand what the code is of where these exist already, because obviously they're prevalent in some areas. Is it possible to find out these towns, see what they have in their code, and send it to us in an email so we can look at what they have and then come back with a better understanding of it?
Yeah, I think that's a good next step for sure.
Okay. I would think that as part of your consideration, if you're going to consider them, you need to consider how they're going to look in that state, because they're never going to move. So you want to make some standards with them where you don't put up the delta rib siding as you're skirting around it. You may want to block or something. That, right. Otherwise, you're going to end up with little trailer houses with metal skirting.
Or potentially, you know, one consideration. Do you want that?
Right.
So we will do some additional research and bring back some suggestions.
So are we considering park model RVs for this purpose, or is this conventional RVs? This is something the Planning Commission is going to have to decide, but just to ask what...
These would be park model RVs.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, but we're only allocating so many of the paths to them. Yeah. You know, because you don't want this whole place struck with park model IVs, and then nobody else can bring in, like, somebody that's bringing in a real RV or mobile home or something like that.
I need to know more how it works. Between the two, and I guess my concern would be we have something that's called an RV park, but it's pretty well permanent.
What I would recommend is what I've learned from the public hearing tonight, which is great because this is why you have public hearings, is we're talking about somewhat two different things. Mm-hmm. We're talking about an RV park where occupants, the owners bring their own vehicle, come and go.
Correct.
Okay? But now the public comment is interested in also having units that stay there more like a mobile home park or something that, and it's rented on a short-term basis. if that is a model that we're considering, which is not necessarily what was totally envisioned here, then I think we need to bring forth some different and additional provisions that deal with short-term vacation rental RVs as a whole different kind of discussion than a typical campground style, which is what was a, which I think was just what
before,
staff
before I can get to that state, yeah. I would like to just see the code of what that
yeah.
is like, and
yes.
and
yeah.
then I can come back with whether or not, you know, this is right
and
for these areas or
exactly
also what I will
is.
Provide is some photos and everything.
That's right. We can get it from our
yeah.
staff.
Yeah.
yeah. So.
No, I'm going to give it to the staff
yeah.
so that they can give it to you.
Well, I'm actually very familiar with them. I spent 4 years in Westport, and they're very prevalent down there. They're
mm-hmm.
they meet HUD standards. They're licensed by the state of Washington as a recreational vehicle, but they're basically what everybody considers or hears about what's called a tiny home. Still a
yes.
still a recreational vehicle. You know, they can come from anything from vinyl siding to wood siding to there's a whole caveat, so you would need to regulate.
So, Mike,
them.
I want to get back to what the genesis of this was, and when you started talking about the development of the Middle Fork, what is the Mountains of Sound Greenway need, and how was it communicated to you? Is this because there's limited camping there? There's, what, 34 sites?
Yeah, there's one campground in the Middle Fork Valley.
And then there's some other non-sanctioned sites that are back there that...
Those are being closed down, yeah, the dispersed camping.
I think, you know, when this came to us, this piece of property is actually a really nice forested piece of property. So having additional lodging opportunities that are integrated into the trees in a campground style was definitely something that we thought was a potentially positive approach at that exit. I think based on, like we said, what we're talking about now is also having short-term vacation rentals out of RV, trailer, whatever the term you want to use. So with that, I think you definitely want to add some regulations on how many can, what percentage could be on that site, you know, versus the owner occupant, the drive-in.
I'm going to say to the commission yeah. right now, with a hotel there and with a hotel coming at exit 31, I don't see a need for more longer-term rentals or permanent rentals. We have facilities for that. What I think is missing is that camping facility.
Yeah,
and how do we, you know, how much land and acreage we have available for this purpose versus cutting into EP1 or EP2 zones, and it'd be better if we keep it in interchange.
Just to let you know, as a developer?
Thank you. I let you comment, but your period is over.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we can't keep going back and forth.
No
thanks.
Problem.
So I'd like to hear from the commission if they have any other comments or thoughts. Yes, Ms. Ryan.
What do we know from the Greenway discussions about potential for establishing recreational sites up the Middle Fork?
In terms of camping,
yeah.
I have not heard of any proposals for additional campgrounds.
Is it likely to happen, though?
Is it likely to happen?
Yeah.
I would say not based on current plans. They're doing a lot of work with trailheads and day use areas, but everything that I've seen is just related to that, not overnight camping.
I'd like to support Ms. Riccardi's statement. Is what they heard was there was a lack of day use facilities. There are plenty of longer extended hikes, and there's the Middle Fork park area where you can park for extended time if you're going in the backcountry, but there's only one campground, and there's not, unless they build some off, you know, one or two.
Do we know properties back there that could be developed with the amenities needed for recreating public? I'm just thinking that This is an opportunity that is right here now, but at some point, as that Middle Fork becomes more and more usable, there's going to be a demand for recreation.
I think the thoughts are being put around, and I don't know, you two probably heard the same thing. Catman's mind is on DNR property, and the thought is when they're done that would be a perfect place to extend, you know, a shuttle service for day use or, you know, long-term parking. So that's it.
That was 50 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Well. So I'm just clarifying in my head here that this particular zone would allow, for example, a four-story hotel. Mm-hmm. So this is, the landowner is saying, hey, you know, I'm going to hold off on a hotel, I'm going to do this now. I'm sitting here thinking, heck yes, whatever we need to do, instead of what if and all this other stuff, because if that's the land use that we've already laid out, mm-hmm. This to me is pretty close to a much improved. That's my opinion at the moment.
So it sounds like next steps is, in light of the fact that this is also could include short-term rental of
established or existing
use. Yeah. That would stay there and not go with the owner, we are going to come back with some thoughts on that to present to you.
Okay.
Okay?
Sounds great.
I just need to know how it works. And in particular, the concern would be the idea is to bring in tourists who don't want to hike into the backcountry, but want to be able to access what we've got out here. How do we do that without becoming someone living there?
Exactly. And that's
or moving over.
That's going to be
one spot. Then.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll do that.
Okay. Anything else? Planning Commission. All right.
So we will have a public hearing formally scheduled for that at your next meeting. So we'll bring back the additional information and also hold the hearing.
Thank you. So the next item on our agenda is item number 5, the public hearing and amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 18.34.050 design standards, single family and cottage residential relating to architecturally related provisions and North Bend Municipal Code Chapter 17.08.105 lot layout and design. Are there any updates from the staff before we begin our public hearing?
Yeah. I just wanted to kind of remind you, we've already actually had a public hearing on this. It was on July 28th. The reason why you're having a second public hearing is what we did is during our deliberations on this topic, a lot of the conversation kind of went back to kind of lot size and lot layout and design. So what we did from that discussion is we took that section of our code, which was 1708, it's back here, and we moved it into this section, which is now included in this provision under H, and we don't have page numbers on here, but if you go to the second to the last page, you'll see at the very bottom, lot layout and design. Mm-hmm. So basically, the biggest change is we've taken it from another section of our code, which is in chapter 17, and moved it here. We only made one change to it, and that is found at the very bottom of the page in the last sentence under lot size, where we say no more than two adjacent lots shall be of the same size. Same size is defined by 500 square feet. So it used to be three. We have moved this lot width. You'll see now we have, one of the goals we had was trying to, with the architectural stuff, really minimize the cookie cutter look. And in doing that, we also incorporated some setback provisions. And now we're incorporating the lot size. And what we're saying is the lot width, no more than three adjacent lots shall have the same width. And that would be defined by 10 feet. And then no more than two adjacent lots shall have the same size. And you actually may want to consider, because after putting this in, I think we probably, if you go to two for lot size, you might as well go to two for ease of administration mainly. But that's something to consider. Anyway, so that is the main change, is that little section there. Otherwise, everything else that you spoke about and discussed in the previous meetings is encapsulated in this, including the
kind of percentages on setbacks. And then the one thing that we did not have at our last two meetings was Leroy Gann, who is our city's consulting architect. So Leroy has helped us in numerous ways over the last couple of years. He kind of acts as our professional to go and get architectural advice when we're dealing with hotels or Phoenix Plazas that are coming in, and we really want some more higher level architectural professional input. So Leroy actually has assisted us in, you know, making sure the code is not only accomplishes what we're trying to do, which is create more variety in the architecture, but is also architecturally buildable. So Leroy's played a lot. He's reviewed the whole thing, and so he's here tonight to answer any architectural questions that you might have for him that can really get dialed in on a much deeper level from a technical standpoint. So that sound looks like why you're here?
Sounds good.
Okay. Leroy, thank you.
How are you going now? Well, you're good to go.
All right. Well, first item of business is to open up the public hearing, and I'll dispense with all the instructions, seeing no one from the public present. It is 7:29. I will go ahead and officially open the public hearing, and I will close the public hearing, seeing no one present. We will move on to Planning Commission questions and deliberation. Anybody like to start? I guess I'll ask. Okay, go ahead.
First of all, these are not serious ideas, just the code is great, but I do have a problem with the use of a word. I had to look up three different ways. Fenestration, is that a common word?
What page are you on?
Public.
It is a very common word.
I've never heard it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's used in the architectural community.
But I mean, the average opening public person wouldn't know what that is. Yeah. Just, why can't you just say Little Island?
Well, is that a frustrated banker? That might be, Dick. But it also includes doors, too. It can be, you know, a combination of doors and windows, and that's probably, you know, why it's used. I mean, it could certainly say doors and windows.
It's not a big deal, but I read that. So yeah. Why is this here? It's not a professional document.
Well, it is actually. Keep in mind, a lot of the readers and users of this is not the general public. That's just coming to read some amazing literature. It's actually the architects that are coming to figure out how to construct a building in North Bend. So it is actually kind of somewhat of a technical document that way. So that might help.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had the same problem with notes. I never had notes. What the hell is that?
The comment on the last page of the document, paragraph 2, we talk about a common driveway for 4 homes.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like an awfully crowded environment for a community. Is that what we want?
Well, a common driveway for 4 homes doesn't mean that the density has anything to do with the density. So right now we have a number of common drives down on Malone Grove that are, you know, 1-acre lots that share 4, you know, 4 homes might share. It could be in your CLDR, which is zone 2 DUs per acre. Somebody might have 2 acres and decide to build 4 homes and have just 1 drive. So what we're saying is we're setting a threshold as to how many can actually be on that shared drive before you actually have to build a road. So it doesn't mean it's going to be crowded. It just means only 4 homes can share a driveway, regardless of size.
Commissioner Ryan, if I can jump in with a question. Is there a width requirement for that when it's shared?
We have driveway standards in a different section of the code.
And also fire access.
Fire access.
Yeah. Over,
which will override.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So 8 feet, 10 feet, 12 feet, any guess?
20 feet for fire access.
For fire, yes.
It's, that, again, depends on the length of the driveway.
So we're not really talking about a driveway as much as it's almost a private road.
That's the case often with these, that, you know, tucked into the corner of the development where it's not easy to provide a cul-de-sac bulb or something like that, they'll put a shared driveway to access three or four homes.
Yeah.
And the only it's not always 20 feet. It really comes right. down to whether it's 150 feet from the furthest point of the
public access.
No, the hose going around the house. So for the fire. So it really could be if a fire truck has to go down it, turn around, it's 20 feet. They don't have to go through it and they can fight from the road. It doesn't necessarily have to be 20 feet. So, but we have like curb cut standards and, you know. So this does not really become an issue. Very often.
Commissioner Ryan, I don't know if that helps you at all.
I'm sorry.
My vision of that is different, but I've seen a number of situations like Tanner where there's a single drive, they peel off in two homes, and they're very close together, but it did allow for access to the residence, so that was workable. The building orientation issue, I don't understand it, so I'd like to just have it explained to me. This seems to be, it says that that homes would be oriented towards the front home will be orientated towards the street.
Mm-hmm.
And that one of the reasons for that is that it helps people stay oriented to where they are. Are you talking about, if a home is on an angle to the street, there might be a misimpression that the street is going north side or the house is going north side. What is that?
Building orientation. To ensure buildings relate to the public street, providing pedestrian orientation. That's the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
So basically what the goal is that the homes don't have their backs to the street or their sides to the street. So homes that face a street with front door and have a pedestrian orientation, ultimately you have a safer neighborhood because the human aspect of the house is facing the street versus if you've ever seen, where sides of the house face the street, it becomes kind of a dead space.
You see this actually a lot in areas that don't have very clear design standards where a developer will just try to tuck in as many homes as possible and it really looks ugly.
Yeah,
the back of the house facing the front of the other house. And
I can visualize that. I'm just saying that if we're talking about this, trying to get variation to our neighborhoods, that sometimes, if you're talking about large lots, not smaller lots, but these half-acre-sized lots, if the homes were oriented towards the geography or the topography of the land, instead of having to cut and fill and make it face a certain direction, wouldn't that be more practical for the developer and also provide a different type of feeling in the community?
I think this doesn't relate to, and you could maybe talk about it from an architectural standpoint, but this doesn't really change how you would cut and fill a piece of property. You could still do a garage light if it is on a slope, you could still do a daylight style and it really actually relates to designing the home too, because you have other provisions in here that says orient the home and the windows and to the views of surrounding areas. So this is more related to if you are developing a piece of property and you're going to provide a street, you actually this kind of makes developers have to think through. Okay, it makes more sense to locate the street here because I can line up or I can provide, the homes facing that street versus more choppy style.
I mean, the first thing the developer is going to do is analyze the site, and based on topography, you're going to start to figure out how everything's going to fit in there.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at views, you're thinking about sun angles. I'd like to hope that they're thinking about those things, but. You know what I mean? And the land sometimes tells you what you can and can't do. So it's on the front end of developing parcels. so it, then it becomes down to, well, the road needs to go here then. You know, so the houses can still, the easement can still front on the street. And if you think about it, you know, not all these streets are, you know, parallel and perpendicular in these developments. So the streets do move, and therefore the house did well.
I have another question.
Absolutely.
Thinking back about how rural communities develop, it's oftentimes individual lots, a lot is sold, a guy comes and builds a home. A year later, the next lot's bought, the guy builds a home, and the homes are different, not in architectural style, but maybe orientation. And over the life of the community, it begins to have this rural feel that we're talking about we'd like to retain in our community, but we don't keep pushing ourselves away from that. We keep thinking about having homes parallel to this and even off this, and so we don't get that rural feel because of time frames, I guess, that we're building. So how can you build a rural feel?
I think it, you know, a lot of it comes down to lot size. You know, the bigger lots are going to give you a more of a rural feel, right?
Yeah.
You know, allows for a bigger setback, allows you to be, you know, away from the street, and create a better, private space for yourself. As you get closer to the street, of course, that privacy starts to go away. You become more of, you start to become more of that, you know, what's happening on the street. Which is, you know, it's a good thing in some developments, where densities are, you know, are constantly increased. But I think the big part of it is, you know, the big driving force would be lot size.
Dick, I wonder, are you thinking about as you drive, I don't remember that one name of the community, but it's Cedar Falls, and I can't remember the street you drive down, but they're all really close to the road edge, and they're all in a line.
Yeah.
And that's what, Molina Grove. So I'm with you where we don't want to encourage that, but I'm wondering how can we be specific in our code when we say, well, we want the front facade orientated to the street. It doesn't mean that it should be, you know, all in a, well, we kind of have that here, right? It's not all in a row. It's varied in our setbacks. So I follow what you're saying. I think we're there in our code, but you can disagree.
Thanks. I'm not trying to disagree. I'm just asking Lori as a Rotarian with me.
We talked about this stuff on Thursday morning.
All right. Thanks for
talking to me.
Anything further, Mr. Ryan?
No, sir. Thank you.
Thank you for your excellent questions. Anyone else? Yes.
Okay, we kind of been talking about a little bit on the issue of porch size and roofs, and the impact of adding the extra, and I think that was actually one of the things that led us to say, can you
what?
Podcast had a little bit to do with that. Particular issue.
Yeah,
port size and the issue with roof line and what that would do in order to be able to extend out over larger porches if we made them a bit bigger.
So we basically went from, just to kind of give Leroy a little
a recap.
We basically went from a minimum depth of 6 feet to 7 feet, and then we said on all size as measured at the porch, well, from the wall of the house. So we increased it from 6 foot depth to 7, and then we said 7 on all sides. Then let's see here, if we turn the page, what else did we do? Oh, with cottages, we did the same thing, which is similar to the first one cottage code that we've been kind of, but the actual porch size is, for the cottage home, is smaller. It's only 64
square foot. Before.
For the cottage, but we said 7 feet on all sides rather than saying 80. And then the other.
So 7 feet minimum.
Yeah, on all sides. Yeah. And then the single family home, the normal size home is the 80 square feet. So the cottage, we went with one to allow it to be a little smaller to be in line with the smaller house. Cause,
yeah, which makes sense.
But still wide enough for my rocking chair.
Yeah, and the difference, if you recall, the reason why 80 worked before is our minimum size cottage was 1,700 square feet, excluding the garage. If we continue, you're going to see the cottage code coming up in the next month to two. We're taking that down to 1,500 square feet, which is why this makes, you know, more sense to be in line with the small. So that's the recap.
Okay. Well, so we went from 6 feet in depth to 7 feet, and that makes perfect sense to me because 6 feet really is somewhat unusable. Mm-hmm. You'll find 7 feet is probably the bare bones minimum. I mean, the square footage is such that you could actually be a little bigger, right? I mean, you could be 8 foot if you wanted to. Is there a max?
No, this is
just
a minimum.
Yeah, it's just a minimum. So I would say that's a wise thing. 7 feet is much more usable. 6 feet, you know, when you take into account railings or, you know, steps or setting a flower pot down on the edge, you know, it just starts to reduce that to where it's just, you're just passing through, mm-hmm. you know, so 7 feet is really going to make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the questions,
that's the big thing here, I think.
That had been raised explicitly was pushing that out, whether or not it was going to affect issues with the roof to result in that pitch having to be flatter and flatter in order to pull, to come out.
Yeah, so,
yeah. Or do a second. Having to have a second.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to solve that. You know, a separate roof is probably, you know, from a street appeal look is probably the best way to go. And that's what I would do. We start to break up roof forms, and mm-hmm. you know, which is always easier on the eyeballs than one big roof, and we're just going to try and cover everything, including the porch. So. I think it forces designers into that mindset, and that's what you want them to do. You know, you want, that's what creates that diversity. And there's lots of different ways to create that roof form, you know, for that porch or stoop.
I remember we had this last time. Mm-hmm. What I was stuck on was the width of the porch as it relates to the roof that's coming down over it and how that affects the second floor versus the first floor. From a builder's perspective, I mean, the porch I have in my mind as a kid, probably 12 feet wide, mm-hmm. and there's a roof over it, and the range you hear it, that kind of porch.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So this piece is we're trying to make a porch,
right,
for the aesthetic,
right,
and oh, by the way, it should be functional. It seems like.
I think so. I think because otherwise, like I said, you're just passing through.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the porches I know, primarily in accent.
Trying to get the key in the lock so you don't do that.
Right. All right, well, thank you. Anything further from the Planning Commission? So, would anybody like to entertain a motion?
Oh, I have one more note.
Yes.
I noted that siding materials, paragraph C1. There's a game we're talking about cedar station singles on siding. We eliminated cedar shaped roofs, but we didn't eliminate the cedar materials on the siding. Is that a different issue?
Yeah. You guys made the discussion about the roof, the cedar shaped roof. Cedar siding, or we didn't talk about, I don't think, the siding.
No, I think we caught the roof is probably. In particularly in the forest overhead that we're talking about, fire hazard, but mm-hmm. but that having cedar shapes and cedar shingles and the siding material, does that constitute a fire hazard in your mind, or is that not as likely?
I don't think it's as likely. And you might have something to add on that too, but I think, you know, on the roof surface, higher probability that, you know, an ember that is, you know, by fire is going to land on that roof, and then that's going to be a problem. Now, they do have fire retardant cedar shakes available. They are out there, they guys are doing, because it has been a problem. But I think it's different on vertical wall surfaces, and I don't think that's something you want to take away from the palette, because that, you know, really can create a nice look.
Yeah, that's an important.
As a wall material, as a siding material. And I just give that, it's not the same thing as that, you know, that flat surface that can catch that amber.
That in the soffits.
The prairie analogy was Eastern Washington tumbleweeds on fire.
Yeah.
Hit the side of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, you'll find the river rock goes up 3 or 4 feet off the top.
Yeah, a lot of jurisdictions over there. If you're a bank, it's not possible all the way around. So you start seeing some stuff on the hardy. People are getting real creative with how to use it, because it's not a pretty material. You know, unless you're creative in how to use it. You don't see it as much over there. Over here, it's a different animal. You know, there's so much moisture in our air that it all stays fairly damp. Pretty much all the time. Yeah. And it looks pretty.
I'm believing it.
Yeah.
Jenna, when you were doing your introduction, point five, item number one, which is on the last page, were you talking about changing lot width to 2 instead of 3 to match?
Well, yeah, you know, as I was
lot size.
Went out, we have subdivisions. So we're on the very last page of this document. Subdivisions shall additionally meet the following lot size and width variation criteria. Number one is lot width, no more than we say 3. Residential lot shall have the same width. We originally chose to mix it up because we thought it actually, we kind of think it makes for more diversity. So let's stick with that. I started thinking about from a, because there's two things. Sometimes, you know, as we regulate them, as everybody comes in, everything like this creates a lot of double check the checking. So this will be an interesting one, but I think it's probably best to keep it. Otherwise, if you made them similar, the reason why going similar is usually lot width and size kind of go together. So if they were the same, if they were 2 and 2, it definitely, I might, it actually might be more logically logical for the actual structure placement.
So if we have a requirement that no more than 3, but if they're doing every 2 because of some reason for their design, the lot size is going to vary for that model to fit the setback with the width, the 15 feet or whatever. So they're going to vary anyway for maybe 2 to 3.
Yeah, see, from the street, okay, so if we think about it from our interests, I mean, we're you know, the regulations are for a number of reasons. But one is, so, you know, one of the goals we're trying to do is to accomplish is not have as much cookie-cutter feel. Lot width is actually from the public realm, so the sidewalk, it's the most noticeable. So if you have a lot that's, you know, 500 square feet larger and it's just longer, you're never going to see it. Width-wise, you see it, though, because you're from on the street. So that's why I thought about width is actually probably more of an impact from the public realm as a needed change than size.
You may not even need the size provision because the width is going to do that anyway.
So I would probably suggest taking the width to 2 and leaving, go two and two. Because then you really get, you're going to get a 60-foot lot, a 60-foot lot, and then a 70-foot lot. And typically on a 70, that a 10-foot lot width difference, which is also going to affect the size, usually changes the actual house.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're looking to
maximize the lot.
So I would recommend going to two on that.
Ms. Gildersleeve?
I don't know. I'm just getting a visual in my head. They're up on Snoqualmie Ridge off Orchard. It's one of the little ones off to the side. There are a series of what I would call kind of cottage homes, smaller. There's an alley that runs behind one row of them. But there is a section that makes me think of this idea because they have three houses kind of side by side, slightly different. And then there's this random house kind of turned in on the side. It has a shared driveway with two of those houses, and I wonder if we could end up with a situation like that, where there's one kind of tucked off behind. With
not because of this provision.
Okay.
This provision, now, I think your last provision is saying why homes need to orient to the street.
Mm-hmm.
Is your key. That's your key. That's not a reason why that provision is actually there.
It's kind of just randomly.
Yeah.
Is it a corner lot?
It technically it would be, but it basically you go down. There are these houses here. There's a little driveway, and then there's this just random house stuck in there, and then it's not connected to the rest at all. And it orients in almost into a gully on one side. I think they just tucked it in.
Yeah.
But it made me wonder with the if they're trying to puzzle piece to get to use every available scrap of land, could we end up with a situation where you have some house that kind of gets isolated in that way?
Yeah, this provision just wouldn't prohibit that, but your last provision would.
Okay.
Well, Elizabeth, now you're giving me pause to think more about Commissioner Ryan's comments about sharing four driveways. One driveway sharing.
Is it an illustration issue?
What?
Shared driveways are shared driveways are a benefit, and the reason is if done right, or if done in a lower density atmosphere, you actually preserve a lot less cuts on your sidewalk. So when you have a driveway slammed in every. If the lot's 50 feet wide, your driveway cut ends up being about 20, 22 with the 16 plus the wing. And then you do that multiple times. What happens is you can't have, it breaks up your biochannels because you have to pave that, you know. And so when you can consolidate driveways, you actually get a lot more vegetation, a lot nicer planter strips, a lot better stormwater biochannel look and feel. So I think the four is good as long as you have all the other provisions.
Okay.
I thought add on that.
Whose kid gets on the driveway one day?
Well, this is homeowners association.
Maybe it's the way it's worded. I mean, is it an actual driveway or is it drive access?
It's more of an access.
It's an access. I mean, a driveway is what we pull off of the access and we have in front of our house.
Right.
Essentially, so maybe that's part of the shared driveway. It's a shared drive access.
It's a shared access, is what it is,
and we can change that.
Yeah, it might be a good idea because it's actually different from a driveway.
Anybody disagree?
No. Could be an alley.
Why don't you go shared driveway / access? We have other section of the code that refer it as a driveway, and I just want to make sure it's still consistent.
Okay.
Just kind of in the vein of why it's a good idea. We're spending all this time about varying the roof lines and varying the colors of paint so it doesn't look the same. And then it's 20 feet of sidewalk, driveway, 20 foot, you know. So it would defeat our purpose.
My only nightmare is the four homeowners who are going to have to maintain that 50 feet of road that the builder buries a tree under in 15 years. So personal experience now.
Sometimes the nice way this is done is when you have a shared driveway that accesses four garages off the back, and the homes front a nice green, where you have others doing the same, so you might have two homes or three homes around a green, mm-hmm. and your driveway's in the back of your house. So this mm-hmm. allows for opportunities that are actually pretty beneficial from a look and feel standpoint.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'll just say this again, I can say it all the time, it doesn't really matter. I think what we found in our cottage home code is a balance of some kind between what people think of as single family homes and what we're trying to explain as a cottage. My original energy around cottage homes, a good portion of the single family structures did not have an attached garage, didn't have a need for a driveway. So it's, I watch this dance happening, it's exciting and frustrating at the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Any final thoughts or changes?
Just one thing, I guess, it's along the Maloney Grove, I think there was common, I actually need to drive on some of the subdivisions, but if they all look exactly the same, when you're looking down, is that because of the same lot width?
In that case, I think a lot of that has to do with they maximized the front, or they minimized the front setback. They were just barely meeting the 10-foot front setback at the time. That's now been increased to 20 feet. Mm-hmm. And together with the increased lot sizes, you won't see that same scenario.
However, think about it. You know, it's kind of funny because we talk about rural. Downtown North Bend is your town. That's your small town. And it is, on average, older homes were close to the street. Mm-hmm. They were small. They had a nice front porch that had access to the sidewalk. So that style of development is actually in keeping with small town. The difference between small town of the 50s and small town of 2000s is bulk and mass of the buildings. The lot sizes actually aren't that. I mean, yeah, maybe they're 2,000 to 3,000 feet different. But that's like the big difference. Like when you really look at downtown or North Bend, rural to me is 5-acre lots, picket fence with horses, and
riding lawnmowers.
Yeah. That's rural to me.
Chainsaws.
That's not North Bend. That's Fall City to me. Mm-hmm. We are a small town with rural atmosphere surrounding us. But when you really look at the pattern of old small towns. So the key is coming back to, you've done a lot for the architecture. Next, what we're going to get into is the bulk and dimensional, which is actually, because you've even required that one home be a one-story, which will help that bulk. And then when we get into bulk and dimensional standards, that's where you could actually say your building footprint, and you might decide to reduce the size of your building footprint. So anyway. Kind of, there's a whole bunch and menu of tools to kind of try to accomplish what we like in the realm of our committee. So this is a part.
So back to the question you had on lot width, you prefer we change that to 2?
I think so, because I think that's what you want. That's your
that's the most visible
impact.
Kind
yeah.
of walking by. Noticeable thing. Mm-hmm. Anybody with the Planning Commission disagree? Under subdivision, your lot width, it currently says no more than 3 adjacent residential lots shall have the same width. And staff is recommending we change 3 to 2. Just for that is going to break up the monotony.
Same width within what? How much variation do you need? 6 inches or 6
10
feet?
10 feet.
Not less than 10 feet.
So you have two, like for example, you could have two homes that are 60 foot wide width, or two lots, 60 foot, 60 foot, and then you would have to have 50 or 70. So what ends up happening is you're going to get different homes.
Sure you are.
Because
mm-hmm.
they're not going to waste that extra 10 feet of square footage that they could sell in a home.
And they just changed by one, so every third lot is going to be different.
Every two.
Other than? Same thing?
Every time, yeah.
Yeah,
two of the same.
Change.
You're right.
Yeah, you go two.
Yeah.
And you could end up with multiple variations. You could end up with a wide one and then two down. You end up with a skinny one because it's all going to be about what land mass you have and what your optimal sizes.
Yeah, so that's what I was kind of thinking about. Because if I've got a semi-meandering road and I've got some topography or some wetland or something that I've got to work around, all of a sudden 260s is going to meet only 10 left before I make the turn. That's sort of. I like it. I think it's going to force good things. Just trying to think of that.
All right. So we're all good with two then. So change five, item one, no more than two adjacent residential lots. So that's the same width. Okay. Any final thoughts or comments? I would love to entertain a motion to approve the amended North Bend Municipal Code 18.34.050 design standard single family cottage residential relating to architecturally related revisions and North Bend Municipal Code Chapter 17.08.150 lot layout and design.
So moved.
A motion by Commissioner Gildersleeve. A second?
I'd like to second that.
Second by Commissioner Ryan. Any final thoughts or comments?
Are we going to see this again?
Nope. Not if you put it.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
I'll just go to City Council meeting next.
Are you abstaining or opposed?
No, I'm with you.
Okay.
Let's move it on.
The motion passes unanimously. Okay.
Thank you.
It's good to see you, Leroy.
Thank you, Leroy.
Thank you for coming. All righty. Item number seven, introduction amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 14.12, floodplain management and associated minor amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 14.05, critical areas administration, general provisions and definitions, and 14.08 streams. Who would like to begin?
So you guys remember back in June, we brought you some amendments that followed from what was called our community assistance visit from the Department of Ecology. And that's where they identified minimum requirements that we would need to meet in order to be consistent with the National Flood Insurance Program. So we've made those amendments. And at the same time as doing those amendments, we identified some other things that we also wanted to correct just to bring ourselves further into compliance and to clean up our regulations. But at the time, our focus was the deadline that we had to meet to get those amendments into the Department of Ecology. So we wanted to just stay focused on those amendments. So now that we have additional time, we're coming back to make some of those additional corrections that we didn't have time to do before. So the overall intent is just to bring ourselves into greater compliance with the state floodplain management model and ensure that we're also meeting our community rating system classification. We're a Class 6 community, and we want to maintain that status moving forward. So a couple of amendments to help us with that. A couple of the primary changes. One is that we're clarifying that the flood insurance rate map is our sole basis for determining what's in the floodplain and in the floodway. Our current regulations talk about other special studies that could be done on Ryberry Creek, and we don't want to get into that squishy language because that could be very argumentative. So we want to just base it on the firm. Another one is we've added a waiver for certain floodplain development permits. For first of all, structures that are under 200 square feet, somebody does a shed in their backyard, and we don't want to have them have to pay $154 for a floodplain permit for that kind of thing. We've also added to that some minor improvements that are within the confines of an existing building. Like if you're replacing a hot water heater, technically you still need to do a floodplain permit for that if you're in the floodplain. However, we don't want people to have to pay for that. We want them to just be able to kind of self-certify that, yes, I'm meeting the floodplain regulations in this case. And so we're therefore waiving the floodplain development permit fee for those kind of improvements. We've also reduced our substantial improvement tracking requirement from 10 years to 5 years. So substantial improvements are when the value of the improvements that you're proposing in your permit exceed 50% of the valuation of the existing structure before the improvements are made. And in our code right now, and consistent with the National Flood Insurance Program, you have to ensure that you're not exceeding that consecutively with multiple permits. You don't want somebody to come in and do a permit here, then come in 2 weeks later and do something else, so that you're incrementally getting over that 50% threshold. And our code to do that right now says you can track that for 10 years. 10 years is a long time, and with staff turnover and with just a number of other factors, that's hard to deal with. So what we're proposing is to take that down to 5 years and to also simplify the implementation of it by exempting out certain things that really aren't affecting the floodplain. So things that are internal to a building, tenant improvements, for example, commercial tenant improvements, that could very quickly take somebody up over that threshold for substantial improvement. But it's not really affecting the floodplain because it's just internal to the building. At the same time, a substantial improvement to a commercial structure or bringing a structure like a strip mall into compliance with floodplain regulations to floodproof or to elevate an older building is probably prohibitive. You'd have to tear down the building. So we didn't want that to be a punishment to investment within our downtown and our commercial structures. We also exempted certain maintenance activities. So if you're just replacing your hot water heater, you're re-roofing your house, you're doing things to keep your house in good condition, that shouldn't be counted against you in that substantial improvement threshold. So we specifically exempted that. Otherwise, we've just done a number of other cleanup edits that make the regulations easier to implement and easier to follow, making some of the language more consistent with the state model and just otherwise more clear. So I'll turn it over to you to ask for questions.
Thank you, Mr. McCarty, for that wonderful introduction. Planning Commission, before we go into this document, in my motion, or what I read off, did I say as amended for the previous document we approved? If not, on the recording, the motion should have been as amended that we agreed to because we did make changes tonight. So, just to correct that. Planning Commission, I understand that we have a very special guest.
Oh, sorry, I didn't introduce Dave.
Mike, would you like to introduce our special guest?
I'm David Spencer. I'm your building official. I do have previous experience as a floodplain administrator in my previous jurisdiction, and I'm well versed in floodplain administration. Not that when I came, I thought I was going to be that guy, but the boot tends to fit. So I have a little bit of expertise, actually quite a bit of expertise in floodplain administration. So hopefully I can answer any technical type questions that you may have or ideas or things of that nature.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for making the time for our commission. We really appreciate that. Who would like to begin? Mr. Lucky. Mr. Lucky.
Sure. Okay. Every time this comes back up, I go back to the original, like everything, I guess, the original property owner perspective. The first level was my great great grandfather owned this property and we never had a flood. Why am I paying flood insurance? It extrapolates from there, and now I'm sitting in this chair listening to our local government saying, well, the Fed said we had to, so we're just going to do it. One of the things that strikes me is an option to mix into this, since we're collecting money for permits and that we hadn't done before. Thank you for the 200-foot thing. That's nice to see you taking care of our folks that way. There's money available that we could sort of help our citizens with survey work to prove that this satellite map done 25 years ago is actually not exactly dead on, and they shouldn't necessarily have to go through the process. It might help our whole city. That's a question. I don't know, David, if you've since you're nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Throwing that one at you.
So I can speak at it. The old maps, the previous 95 studies or 92 studies or whatever, those were done on 10-foot contours. So now the current map, or I guess the map that you see, floodplain that we have, is based on a preliminary firm, that the 2005 study, which those are done on 5-foot contours or less. So the studies that are coming from FEMA that are done King County-wide, jurisdictional-wise, you'll see those. Those are map updates. And when those come, I went through that map update in the city of Westport, and it changed the floodplain regulations. It removed some people from the floodplain, but understand that it also does bring some properties into the floodplain based on the new data and new studies. That will happen over a period of time. I know of quite a few individuals in the Silver Creek area that now have what is called a LOMAR, which is a letter of map amendment. They have gone out, gotten their survey, proven that where their structure is located, that they're actually higher than what's called the BFE, the base flood elevation. So it's removed them from that. So until those better maps come and those are approved, and there will be a long, long public comment period during that citizens should come to and pay attention to, because they'll find out the different things in the different studies. Until that happens, it has to be done by survey work and things of that nature, and that's private property. And unfortunately for us, the city, to pay for things of that, you run into that sticky thing of government funds and so on.
I'm not necessarily saying we should just start writing checks.
Right.
We could at least bold print the information, mm-hmm. so that they can do an aha moment for themselves.
Right.
As opposed to what we're doing just by default, going through our process and said, oh, we got a new regulation, here you go.
Well, I can tell you that since my time coming in January, when they come in now, because everybody, when they want to do this, when this happens, is when they want to get a building permit. So when they come in, then I talk with them about floodplain regulations. And obviously, if a corner of your home touches, the whole home touches. So there's a couple instances already where people have floodplains across their property. They're really close. And I've encouraged them to go get a survey to delineate where that flood line is, so we can determine that they are in fact in or are in fact out, so that way, whether we have to use those type of regulations or not. So I really encourage them to do those. Or if they say it's never flooded or whatever, then I encourage them to seek out surveyors and the LOMAR process, and that they can go through that process to find out before they choose to go build and then be under the regulation. Because all we can do, unfortunately, is while floodplain, I guess floodplain is mandatory. Unfortunately, every home that we all purchase, as soon as that home is purchased by that bank to then carry, because if they can only give $1 billion in loans, they need to unload those loans. Those loans go to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And unfortunately, every loan that carries federal mortgage insurance or mortgage has to have flood insurance. It's mandatory.
You're making my point. I don't really know if you realize that.
Right. And so then you can choose as a community to not participate in that program. The ramifications of that non-participation are no one in your community will be able to get flood insurance, hence no one will be able to get a loan, so the only people that buy here would be cash. So we have to participate. And then the benefit is the CRS program that Mike spoke to. That's voluntary by the city, enters into that program. They entered in 2006. Class 6 translates into a 20% reduction of flood insurance rates for every citizen that has to pay flood insurance. And we just went through the CRS program, and that roughly right now translates into $198,000 that stays in your community, because otherwise that insurance money would go off to what I call Mutual of Omaha of Nebraska. And so that does revitalize your community, but does bring with it a little bit higher regulatory standard that everyone must participate, so that the few that are in the floodplain, because not all of us are in the floodplain,
so
then we benefit from
David, it. David, I thank you. And what it sounds like is you were going door to door. Jim, I think that's more above what you were expecting. But how can we duplicate this so everybody that's in the flood insurance, what you're asking is how can we get the word out without you having to go door to door?
It's about education. We're working on that. We've now got a building department webpage that talks about some of those things, has links to FEMA and that, and it's also on our public works page. That's all part of our CRS program. And when we went into the new program we just went through, Mike was integral in it, public works was, and we hired a consultant because she's a certified floodplain administrator. All of those things are part of us participating. It's public outreach is part of what we do. Everyone in the floodplain gets a letter every year. So it's out there, and it's just better education when they come in the door about explaining why we do what we do. Because you're right. If you come in and I just say, well, you're going to build a new house, well, you got to elevate your house. Well, why? The guy next door doesn't have to. So it's really about an education process and why the one thing that you want to do as your individual cannot adversely affect the community. So we ensure that everybody has the same standard. And it's just an education process and talking with people. And we're getting really good at it, and it's getting better for people.
I had to get smaller paintbrushes.
Yeah.
Thank you for all that extra work, too. Okay. Mr. Ryan, I believe you had something.
Straight off on page 8. Paragraph 3 and then paragraph 4 below that slide where it says the loss of flood water is emphasized should not exceed 5 feet per second. How is that calculated in advance?
It is calculated on your flood study. So your map is basically based on a flood study. And then if we get into floodway waters, which there's very limited instances where you can do things in floodways, then an engineer would have to go and look at that flood rate study, and there's a model. The best example I can give you right now is your River Glen development that's currently going on. Their intent is to take the portions where the building pads are and those to be elevated above the base flood. Basically, let's just call it the distance of the pavement from here. But to compensate for that, because they have to account for all of the storage, because you can't displace your neighbor, they're over-excavating the floodway channels in different areas like that. Well, you will see as it continues to develop that some of those banks are going to have some, what I call as a terminology, riprap. If you don't know what that means, like a bank stabilization of a river, which will eventually be covered by vegetation. But that is to account for some of those velocities, because as you widen that channel and deepen that channel, there are some velocities. And so those have all been calculated in a model. River Glen has all been done by their engineers in a model to ensure what those velocities are, so that we don't have issues or issues of downstream neighbors. I mean, those neighbors, it appears now that there will be an adverse impact, but they're not. They're at the same height, and they're calculating for it on their property, and they're making sure that those velocities do not adversely affect the neighbors. So it's all done in model.
So velocity doesn't relate to volume?
Not necessarily. It's how fast that volume moves, like the Snoqualmie River. Obviously, as it increases with your rains, then your velocity does increase, because your river's constricted as the flow goes up. So that velocity does increase.
So do we also take into effect global warming and the more high water events occurring?
Not in these types of studies. In the coastal studies, yes. I can tell you that because I went through that, but not in this study. No, not currently. No, and this is just based on the current regulations that we have. So, no, global warming is not in effect on this.
You want to continue?
I'm occupied all the time.
Oh, no, because I've got a list of stuff.
This is not a happy topic. I know that a lot of history has been invested on this site, but still, I just need to understand.
Can you let us know where you're at?
Okay, I'm on page 11. Facilities, 14 to go on that here.
Thank you.
Has it not been determined that our flood, that our hotel project is in a floodplain environment?
It's in a floodplain, yes.
Mm-hmm. But it is not a critical facility.
No.
So critical. How do we allow it to be there?
It's not a critical facility. We allow general development in the floodplain, as long as it's not in the floodway.
I could speak to that a little bit about critical facilities.
Yeah.
Okay. Critical facilities typically are your hospitals, your your city hall, if it was your, what you call your EOC, which is when you have your disaster, which this is not your EOC, it's at Public Works, which is out of the floodplain. Unfortunately, a lot of sewer plants are critical facilities, but they're in floodplains because that's the way gravity goes, hence where your sewer goes, so you're limited. So it encourages you to not put those there if you can, but if you can't, then it encourages you to go to a high, little bit higher standard and go to the 500-year floodplain, which is instead of the 1% annual chance, which your 100-year floodplain is your 1% within any given year that you will flood. Your 500-year plan is less than 2% chance that you'll flood in 500 years, but that's you'll still flood, but it's just a higher standard, and it may be as little as 1 foot. But it's just it's called your floodway fringe that's outside the special flood hazard area. So the intent is you really don't want your critical facilities because you have an earthquake or those types of events or flooding. Everybody's going to want to go to those because if we have a massive flood here, you're going to want to put people in your schools, in your gyms. And so that's kind of what you're trying to do.
I think I have the idea now. If it's not a critical facility, it's a commercial project.
Yes.
We allow development in the floodplain as long as they make safeguards and so on.
Yes, as long as they meet flood construction. Yeah.
I'm on the next page, page 12. That page covers a lot of details about what structures are allowed in floodways. And I read this right. Even structures that are there to protect against floodways aren't allowed in floodways. Like water diversion, things of that nature aren't allowed in floodways. Am I reading this right?
That's the intent of all the deletions.
Right.
So instead of saying specifically what is allowed or what isn't allowed versus is allowed, right. We relied on the provision above that says encroachments or development within the floodway is only allowed if you show the following. And that way we don't have to list out dikes and levees and bridge abutments and things like that.
So those facilities are allowed in the floodway?
They are allowed. Yes.
Right, yeah, and the old language kind of limited you if it's not on the list and it's not allowed, and there's some other parameters of things that you can do, dikes and levees, or your, what I've heard is called as the Nintendo bypass, you know, which is levee setback. Those are different things that necessarily if they weren't on the list, then now you're in a situation where your code doesn't allow. So you get rid of the list and you just talk about what's allowed.
And I think we already talked about on page 14 the reference to American Hurricane Katrina of 1988, the last 9 feet. Page 14.
Oh yes.
Is that the study you're referring to when you were talking to Jim a while back?
Yes. The everything done now and current studies are all done on what's called NAV 88. The old studies were done what was called NGDV 29. And our code spoke to NGDV 29 before. But if you don't understand that there's a conversion, so everybody that's using NAV 88, you've got to remember each time to go back and do a 3.58 conversion to know which one they're using. And everything we turn in from our sewer, manhole inverts to stormwater inverts to everything that the city requires for people to turn in for all surveying is all done on NAV 88.
So that's the benchmark, and then you adjust.
Yes, yes. And so we wanted this to be consistent with every flood, with all of our all of the surveys that come in, because you're required to turn in three when you come to see for a building permit. If you're in the floodplain, you have to give me one based on construction drawings, so we make sure that you're going to build it the right way. Then at the first floor before you go vertical, because it's easier to lift the floor than it is to lift the house. So there's, you know, if there's a mistake. And then at the final one. And the final one is the most important one, because that one we have to turn into FEMA every year. And we get graded on that. And we have to get a 90% accuracy rating to remain in the program. And so those become very critical. So we wanted to make sure that this lined up with everything else the city does.
Please, David, seemed to me that our measurement systems today are a lot more agri. Why we don't just do new measurements and go from real time?
It's based on a benchmark system, and that's the system that FEMA uses, and so we're trying to be consistent with that.
Big brush. Mighty brush.
One or two more. I guess we should. Okay, I'm going. I'm looking at 1405 for 200. Are we talking on that one? Flood plain roads.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So I'm looking at page 6.
Okay.
And first of all, the page after paragraph 2 and the line starts off high density, of course, high density land use. High density versus high intensity. The second line there talks about residential more than 1 unit per acre. It seems that if you had a residential building on that acre, that is low intensity, but if I'm mistaken, I'm reading this, that having one house is high intensity.
Yeah, so this definition is in their critical areas provisions. It's not specific to our flood regulations. We've put all of our flood regulations into our critical areas regulations, but this particular definition relates to critical areas, and it's not referenced in our flood regulations. So there's high intensity and low intensity uses, and that's for determining what the buffer widths are going to be when you have one of these uses adjacent to a wetland or a stream.
But it seems like a use is high intensity and no use is a low intensity. Rather, one house on an acre is greater than a high intensity. It's a high intensity use per acre.
Mm-hmm.
In a critical area.
In a critical area, yeah.
And so it's low intensity if nothing's there.
Well, I'm not familiar.
Well, it could be a park, and that could be one, baseball field or just a walking trail, or could be just preserved and not no use,
right,
or no access permitted. Which would be the ultimate.
I just seem like one house would be low intensity.
Makes you wonder what I-90 is.
These are picky, you know. I'm not doing very well.
I thought that the discussion about when a project is permitted, can we call it underway?
And honest to God, I just thought it was really confusing, because it seems like whenever I'm looking at on page 10, and I'm looking at the entire page, we're talking about when is a project that has been permitted, when is it considered to be underway, when is it not. And if I go in there and change the topography in any way, I've started a project, but under this definition, you can build a street and still not be considered to be underway. How can that be? I mean, that just flies against the face of logic. If I have a permit to start a project, technically I'm not starting it until I actually start building a building. If I put all kinds of money in, I put sewers in, I put stuff in, technically I've not started my project yet, if I'm reading this right.
Is that correct?
I need to read the section just real quick.
Well, they're talking about permanent construction. That's maybe different from start of construction.
If I have a building site, I'm putting a road in, and I'm putting sewers in, that seems to be permanent.
Start of construction. So you're looking at the start of construction is what you're looking at?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I just need to go back at the beginning of the section to understand what the section is, and if that's just definition.
If you tell me that it is a nuance that as a regulator you have certain controls over the developer, you don't start enforcing those regulations until a foundation is put in. But it just seems to me, as a citizen, I'm watching a project develop, like
technically speaking, the hotel, that project hasn't started yet. Because all they've done is put a hole in the ground.
I think what we're not seeing here that I need to go back and look at is what the start of construction refer to in the regulations.
Right.
So somewhere that's referenced.
That's what I wanted to know. Because
I think that when the developers on the clock, when they started, when they have a technically started project, I guess they have a certain amount of time to finish under the permit.
That's right, yeah.
So it seems like the clock hasn't started on the start date. Even though they put roads in and graded it and all that, there's still nothing.
I don't think that's what this is referring to, but I need to figure that out.
Okay.
We'll come back to you with more information on that.
That's what I think I've seen here. That's probably what my confusion is.
Yes.
This is associated with the structure.
Right. I can.
So that's different from what I'm telling
you. Elizabeth, you wanted to just.
Yeah. From the perspective of flood insurance, mm-hmm. the rest of that stuff doesn't matter. It's when the structure stops.
Yeah. Right.
So they will apply from the perspective of rating. And determining if it's compliant or non-compliant, what were the standards in place at the time that construction started or the time the permit was issued. So it is actually, from that perspective, it's a very distinct thing, separate from any of the infrastructure work that's being done. It's when that house actually, or that building is actual construction starting. So that may actually bear, since this is in compliant regulation and we're looking at things that FEMA is asking, probably looping back to that particular definition
manual. And just elaborate on that, because that's a very good way to kind of describe it. Hotel's different, because this is about the structure.
Right.
And mm-hmm. ultimately ensuring the structure. The hotel, it is right now, typically, hotel was a little different because it did get early clear and grade, but typically you issue your clearing or your engineering plan, so they build the infrastructure, and then it goes vertical. So the vertical aspect of that project hasn't started, which is what FEMA would worry about, or insurance would worry about.
Yeah, I was going to say that if we could just step back from this section here, just because I see what you're asking me, understand that in your floodplain regulations, from a broad perspective, a hotel site does have grading type permits and all the stuff associated with it in the ground. That requires, if you lose through your regulations, a development permit. When you do pretty much anything in the floodplain by those regulations, that is considered development. Even parking of a recreational vehicle is development. Parking of farm equipment, we don't have some of those things, that's still considered development. So they have permitting and they're abiding by the floodplain regulations through engineering at Public Works for all of the things they need to do on that side. So they are under some regulations, but this dwells down into and is talking specifically related to the structure. And that regulation, which is more in line with everything through FEMA and there, is all about flood insurance. It's all about protecting your physical structure. They're not concerned with the topography of your property. But we do go through a process to address those things.
So in terms of what staff is doing, they're not, the clock hasn't started in terms of the start date, start of construction until something goes vertical.
No, it just depends on the permit itself.
Right.
So each permit's going to have its own tracking and time frame.
Right.
And that's typically done based on a letter of completeness for the particular permit that starts the clock.
Insurance is going to be the time of something.
Structure.
Yeah, but this one is specifically speaking to structure. But
so
I just wanted
for the sake of this discussion, start of construction for the structure has not begun.
And it's consistency because it's pretty standard procedure for them to ask for verification from a community of these things. And if the definition the community is using is different from the definition that FEMA and FIP wants, you end up with inconsistencies in how that's being applied across the country.
Right.
So if you have a project that has broken ground, has an operator, lays an infrastructure, and then has problems with financial backing, they can't get started with the project. How long do they have to start a little vertical before the project is considered?
We typically require a bond upon issuance of clearing grading permit so that if they fail to complete the project, then we have that bond to rely on to restore the project back. it's in stable condition.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask the Planning Commission to go back to the original documents, and if we can try and work through as much as we can, we'll go page by page if that's all right, and just kind of ask if anybody has any comments on each page.
And I feel incredibly pedantic in doing this, but I deal with flood insurance a lot. And the vocabulary gets confusing for people. So from the perspective of the NFIP, floodplain is everywhere. Special flood hazard area are those areas of higher risk.
Right.
So we distinguish floodplain. You don't have to be in a special flood hazard area of high risk. Everyone's in a floodplain. And then within the special flood hazard area, there's an area of further risk, which is the floodway. So just because I remember this well. It was my first lecture in my very first flood class, was to remember that point. And I think that it's helpful for people because when they're looking at things on FEMA, when they're hearing conversations, they will hear them say floodplain, and you hear a lot of, I'm not in a floodplain. Everybody's in a floodplain. Everybody.
FEMA says they want a little bit for everybody.
Well, only the people in the special flood
right.
hazard area
right.
are subject to a requirement to have flood insurance if they have a loan.
But Elizabeth, if I'm at 1,000-foot elevation,
you're still in the floodplain according to the way that they define
yes.
it. You're just not at very high risk of flood.
Just haven't found the arc. Yes. Yes.
Right.
So someone in downtown Seattle on a hill.
500,000 years ago, you were underwater.
You know, maybe at no, you know, they are still at risk of flooding. So you can end up with a flood from, you know, the rain flooding your basement. It has happened in Seattle. There has been a death. So just, and again, I feel a little bit pedantic to bring that up, but I think that it creates some confusion when people hear all these different
right.
things, or if they're looking at FEMA or hearing some of the stuff they talk about. Everyone's in a floodplain. Everyone has some risk of flooding. But the ones that we're concerned about here are the ones in the special flood hazard area that we have to toe the line so everybody can keep their loans and buy houses, to your point.
Pay really. Cash.
Or they have to be able to pay cash. Of course, I don't know that everyone can do that.
Okay. So in our document, we have the staff report. Is there anything of comment there? Okay, so let's move on to the first page. Any comments there? Hearing none. Page two. Page three. Page four. Page five. Page six. And I have page six. Pardon me, I'm very new to this. On point B, or I'm sorry, C. We're talking about sewage and manure waste storage facilities shall be flood-proof to the flood protection elevation. Can you tell me if I have a cattle barn that I keep 20 cows in, is that considered a manure waste facility or not?
No.
Okay. So is there a recommendation on the number of animals in a barn that would constitute a risk to the same extent that a manure facility would?
No, they're two different things. When they're talking about sewer or I guess, manure waste facilities. They're talking about lift stations, different things like that. You're talking about your septic tanks. When you have those, you want those in so that when they're underwater,
I disagree because I've always heard about how cow farms near floodwater rivers mm-hmm. are posing a problem of fecal coliform bacteria. And so what I'm trying to understand is if we're protective about manure storage facilities, exactly how much volume does that constitute? How do we equate that to the same farms that we have along our rivers?
And in this instance, FEMA's not concerned about the cow manure. All these regulations are based upon your livable space.
I have a concern.
Okay. So
that's where I'm trying to understand what does FEMA constitute that level of manure to be a threat to the water system.
I think they're just looking at where it's concentrated. Where is it in a tank somewhere that if it spills, then suddenly it's going to become a waste, a hazard.
So I know a couple of places where they have enough land to have cattle, where they have pigs currently. So trying to figure out in my head, you know, how much is going to matter. And if the one farm that runs along the Middle Fork, where they have the wonderful mules that they show in our parade, went back to cattle, and they have 40 or 50 in there, and that floods, does that present the same risk as a manure storage facility?
Well, you don't drink the river water.
But that contaminates your house. As that flood water goes around the city.
If your property floods
right
at that event.
So I'm trying to understand. So the same thing, if you have a cattle barn and your 20 cows stay in there, that becomes pretty much a manure, depending on how much you clean it out, right? We have a risk to our water system, and that fecal coliform bacteria gets in and spreads around and presents a risk for disease and bacteria to all the residents. So I'm trying to figure out what level is something we ought to be concerned about.
I'm not a farmer, so I can't presume any expertise on this, but I think generally in barns and animal areas, unless it's some really industrial feedlot, they're going to clean up after their animals. They're going to scoop the manure out of the barn and put it into the, whatever it's called, the manure waste bin.
And it may not be there. You've got to call your local KCD office, which is down in the river. I'll put you in contact. We deal with that all the time. It's not a regulatory issue, but it's environmental support. Are you serious? Is this hypothetical? Or is this you're dealing with?
No, I'm totally serious. I think if we have farms that are right next to our river, how is that different than having a manure storage facility if you have a certain level of animals? And there's nothing that would prohibit them from going back to cattle. So we have the same risk to our system. So, yeah, I can certainly do that and come back with a recommendation. So, yeah, sorry, my question wasn't clear to begin with.
No, that's okay.
Next one, point F, water wells should be located on high ground that is not in the floodway. Are we talking about wells or the plumbing that actually pumps the water from the well?
Let me read the comment here. I don't know on that one. I need to look that up. That came from Christina, our consultant, that prepared the amendments.
I would think you would be talking about the pipes.
Seems like it, yeah.
Yeah, I think
equipment you don't want to get inundated.
Yeah.
And do they have to have like a flow shutoff or something mm-hmm. so there's no backfill?
And I'd have to look at that WAC because that came from Dave Radenbaugh from Ecology there, Mike.
I was looking at page 6, item F. Water wells shall be located on high ground that is not the floodway. I'm in the original document. Page 6. You find this?
I see.
Okay. All right. Anything else for page 6?
Sorry, I grew up working on farms.
I grew up in a rural farm, but I never had to worry about that.
You didn't swim upstream, too, did you?
No. If you want to know, my first day on the job was to clean out the cow barn, and I didn't know how heavy a wheelbarrow could be, but I knew I didn't want to make a lot of trips. And so my first couple of steps, I slipped, and it went over.
Memory.
Yes. Yes. Always there. All right. Page 7, residential construction. Item B, fully enclosed areas below the lowest floor that are subject to flooding are prohibited. Is there a reason why?
Hydrostatic pressure, collapse of the foundation. So you either build it to, basically what it requires is you then to put flood venting in those enclosed areas, which would be a crawl space, so that the hydrostatic pressure does not build up, collapse the foundation, which in effect destroys the home.
And so Qualmie, they're building up like 5-6 feet.
Mm-hmm. And they also have venting.
And they have venting in those. And while they have windows and they look like it, they're not intended for human occupancy.
But I can put a workout or a pool table there.
You're not supposed to. Mm-mm. It's unconditioned, unlivable, unhabitable space.
How can we make that livable, habitable, if it's part of my property?
How can you make it?
Yeah. It floods every 100 years. Why can't I put something down there?
She's grousing over.
Because here's what I'm going to say.
You can't have it as an occupancy point, but you could have it as a playroom.
No habitable space.
And
in fact, what happens in most communities is that you will have something on the title that states that, and then when you do that, then you will be in non-compliance. And if you do have an event, or when you have an event, your flood insurance will not cover the damages, and your rates will go up exponentially based on how far below the BFE you are.
And why for to ask for permission?
It doesn't mean that you can't store your camping equipment down there. What this is talking about is you're not finishing it as a space that then is going to become a hazard or a claim that federal flood insurance is heavy.
Right.
Or two people down the road, they don't know that that wasn't allowed, and that you got a bunch of money from the federal government on something that said that you wouldn't ever finish that, and that it was to be passed on to any owner. And while I have never seen it, technically the language of those would allow the federal government to recoup any money that they gave in that grant because you broke the rules. Mm-hmm. Though I haven't seen them do that.
Right.
Okay. So I go further down, and there's the 2 and the 4 feet, and I'm going to tell you, as somebody that goes under their house, I want 4 to 8 feet of space there, because when I have to fix a pipe or I'm going to, you know, remove mice or whatever it is, I want the most space that I can have. In crawling under heating ducts and that kind of stuff is hard enough. So I think 4 feet is the minimum. When you have, I don't know what your heating ducts are, they're 2 feet high, taking up that space.
Minimum depth for your crawl space?
Yeah.
And I can explain that. If you're going to build a true crawl space, then the difference between your exterior grade and your interior grade, there's a criteria, and it's called, you would need to look at the now, I think, is there 12 building diagrams? Because there's a 9, or 6A now or something. I have a big, if you'd love to see them, I have a big flood thing on my wall. Crawl spaces are what's called building diagram 9. In there, the exterior grade and the interior grade cannot be more than 2 feet in difference. Okay?
Hold on. Say that again.
Exterior grade to interior grade, so bottom of crawl space and where your exterior environment is, cannot be more than 2 feet in difference. And there's a reason for that. And the interior grade of your crawl space to the bottom side of your joist cannot exceed 4 feet in height. And that's because that falls under building diagram 9, which is a crawl space. You can build your structure of different building diagrams from building diagram 1, which is an elevated home, which you see enclosed in Snoqualmie. So there's different building diagrams, but this is specifically talking to when you're going to build it in a crawl space application, because up until recently, technically by our code, we didn't even allow crawl space applications in our city. So you use, I can say, Second Street. It's a different building grant diagram. It is like 6.5 feet in there in the crawl space, but it's at grade on both sides, so it's a different building diagram.
But isn't the crawl space the way to elevate above the flood plain?
But then how you eliminate the 4 feet or the 4 foot rule is then, unfortunately, what you have to do is then if you're more than 4 feet here, then you have to go inside your foundation and you have to fill inside your foundation to bring that up to 4 foot or less. And then you can have a variation. You can even have the inside higher than the outside.
Is there a technical reason why with the flood water pressure? Or
yes. Yeah. And so all of your flood vents have to be within, have to be below the base flood elevation to count and within 12 inches of grade. So when the water fills up, then the water flows into your foundation and then it reaches equal buoyancy. So it's all about those requirements. And the reason they don't want you to be in a building diagram, Mike, more than 4 feet, because then it's not considered a crawl space. It's considered a basement. And now your flood insurance rate is based on where you are, how far below the BFE. And the farther you go below the BFE, the more your rate goes up. And that's why we have a 2 foot of freeboard in another part of the requirement, is because that is the magic number where you get the most bang for your buck in flood insurance rates.
If you want a house that has a crawl space, what you consider a crawl space under it, so you can access all of those things, just don't take the crawl space floor at all below grade.
Right.
Then you're golden. The minute it goes an inch below, you run into it.
Right. So you would go down to meet frost for your footing and foundation, then you would fill the inside to the grade level, and you could build higher, but then you're a different building diagram.
Were there different building codes between the county and the city?
No, the building codes are adopted at the state level, and they became effective July 1st, 2016. We're under the 2015 codes. Whether you adopt them or not locally, which we did adopt them in July locally through an ordinance that I adopted, you're required by state law to administer them. If you didn't...
I live in a neighborhood that was annexed to the city,
mm-hmm.
on Tanner Road.
Mm-hmm.
I was built in 84.
Okay.
My home does not resemble this one.
And it may not do that. That's your home. I don't know. Is your home in a floodplain?
I'm on the river.
Okay, so you...
Clearly on floodplain.
Right. And I don't know. I'd have to see your house and see what it was and what that regulation was back in King County. Standards technically are higher than the city of North Bend. We're a class 6. They're a class.
I always thought my crawl space was a flood containment.
It may feel like that to you. So.
If I can share just a little history on this. Washington has this construction style called subgrade crawl spaces because of our water table, where they were digging down and then building up. So it's very common. This is something that has been an issue for the NFIP for years and years and years. And I think starting in the mid-90s, they really kind of dialed in on what do we not like and how do we work with you guys on coming up with the way to rate for it, which is why we now have this diagram line that he was referencing. So it's kind of a, if you have a home with a crawl space that goes down a little bit, usually it's about 18 inches, and it might come up a little bit further so that you have two or three feet in there that you can kind of crawl around. That's totally typical of most homes, even up until the late 90s. And that's, again...
I'm afraid to tell you that.
Well, no, there are
homes. Probably
shouldn't. There are homes that were built with almost full basements under them because they dug down so far and didn't back them.
Nope.
And it's because it's how we built that.
I really thought it was, frankly, flood containment. The Encompass building has a similar depth. Where right on the corner it was typically a flood floodplain, but it was always flooded. They built the basement. The basement has to be, or the area under the thing has to be 5 feet deep.
Just what? Go la, 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 la.
I know, I'm like going, I don't want to do this. I guess my concern is that with something like that, we have a, not to create panic, but we have a building where we house children that in a flood event is at an increased risk of collapse. So thank heavens we closed schools for those sorts of things. So no one's there.
Well, we're a little off subject, but if you look at, if you have flood insurance and you wonder why it is what it is, you can have individuals or even Smart Vent will actually, you can send them what you have now, whatever flood cert you have now, and they will look at it, and they will tell you the different things that you have and why your policy is what it is. And they'll show you either you don't have enough venting or your crawl space is too deep, and so they base you on this. And they will do those things for
I've got venting every 7 feet.
Right. But you may find out, what you may find out is there's some very simple things that you could do to your home that would greatly reduce your flood insurance rate that you don't even realize.
Just burn the yard, Dick. Just burn the whole thing.
All right. I was just trying to figure out how am I going to say this in a different way. The interior grade of the crawl space below the base flood elevation must not be more than 2 feet below the lowest adjacent exterior grade. This is on page 7, mm-hmm. still under D1.
Yep.
Now, if I look at item number 4, it says any building utility systems within the crawl space must be elevated to the flood protection elevation or designed so that the floodwaters cannot enter or accumulate within the system components. So I guess when I'm thinking we have that requirement as a crawl space must be elevated, mm-hmm. can we just make it as simple as possible and just say you can't have a crawl space below the base flood elevation?
But if you say that you can't have a crawl space below the base flood elevation, then you've eliminated building diagram 9. And this language is to allow for building diagram 9, because up until this point, even though that's the way we build here, it's a non-allowed use. And then, so the 2 foot variation is part of your whole building diagram 9, and it's really describing how to build a sub crawl space foundation under building diagram 9. And you're right, it does limit you in the instances that you can, and you may discover what you do, you can't have a building diagram 9, so you need to go to a 1A or maybe, and I don't know them all off the top of my head, a 1C, which does have a corner in, but the majority is out. So there are multiple ways to get there. We just have a habit in the Pacific Northwest of building crawl spaces. And they want to, and under that building diagram, she is very correct. Probably less than, I would say, 10, 15 years ago, they really didn't know what to do with subgrade crawl spaces. And so they really, over time, have really dialed in, and they want to limit those so that someone can't turn them into a basement.
So my last point on this page, must be an adequate drainage system that removes the floodwaters from the interior crawl space.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a basement, can I have a pump system? Some pump, but isn't that better than a perforated pipe or tiles or gravel? But
in a basement application, we're not going to allow you to have a basement in the floodplain. It's not an allowed use to have a basement. So in this instance, in your crawl space, limited to building diagram 9, you're going to have a perforated pipe with drain rock so that it will, over time, as the floodwaters recede, allow that water to dissipate out of your crawl space.
To still have the timing pool below.
For the 2 days it takes for the water to...
Right. And the second page that I talk about your ductwork is...
I'm pumping off the next door.
To talk about your ductwork is that FEMA's regulations include that your ductwork needs to be at the freeboard requirement, because that's the best bang for your buck. Because even if you do your elevation, but your equipment, which is still your ductwork, is considered machinery, is in the floodplain or not above that freeboard, then your insurance rate is based on where that ductwork is. So if you're going to do crawl space ductwork, you go a little bit higher. Otherwise, put your furnace and things in your attic and bring your ductwork down.
Okay. Anything else on page 7, folks? Okay. Yes, sir.
Just a question. Seems like we have an expert, maybe 2 or 3 here. Is it true, my perception, that insurance, the flood insurance is not very expensive relative to other hazard insurance, the liability insurance that most people have on their homes, and that it really doesn't cover much? There's a huge deductible. And at the end of the day, unless you have total loss, FEMA is your backup only supply for insurance, you're pretty much not, you may not even file a claim.
You could probably speak better to that than I can. I know that flood insurance is only for the disaster.
It depends. There's such a wide variety. So the credit, what we're talking about here are homes that are being constructed to be elevated and appropriately compliant from the get-go.
Yeah.
And they could end up paying under $500 a year for flood insurance. But there's also a real, you get that lower rate for a trade-off.
But focus on the coverage part. Pay the $500 a year.
What
right. Get?
But when for those elevated homes, there is very limited coverage in the area underneath the elevated living space. And that's one of the reasons the premium's so low. At that point, for an elevated home, it's based on catastrophic risk. Okay. Does something hit that house and take it down? And that can absolutely happen.
Oh, yeah.
Trust me.
So.
Where it's completely unexpected. The vast majority of the homes, and if we're talking about the homes in North Bend, the vast majority of the homes in North Bend that have flood insurance are going to be what are called pre-firm. So they were built before there was any such thing as a flood insurance program.
Right.
And they're going to be paying, they could be paying $3,000 or $4,000 now for their insurance because of some of the rate changes that have happened in recent years. But I think they're still, for the most part, still in the $1,500 to $2,000 range. But it also depends on what deductible they've elected. And that becomes a perception of risk. People are like, oh, it doesn't flood in North Bend. I'll go with a higher deductible. So, yes, they would have more up front. But a home, you know, like 4 to 6 inches of water in a home can be $40,000, $50,000. A home that gets a foot to 2 feet where the electric gets involved, I've seen checks for over $100,000 written on those. So you can end up with a really catastrophic level that is represented by the fact that this house is closer to, you know, it's going to get more water.
What I'm trying to get to is a sense. Because we are, and every probably government entity is spending a ton of time rewriting our code for FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it gets down to. For the consumer who's out there paying the insurance and paying us to do this job, I'm wondering what the real benefit is. To me, I've always understood. You kind of got to have it. Maybe if your mortgage is 80% loan to value, you've got to have flood insurance because it's got to be backed by the guys who don't want to take a risk. But at the end of the day, there's a premium that you pay, and the deductible is normally substantial.
It depends.
Well, I know you sound like a practitioner. It depends.
Well, it's just because there is. There are a lot of factors.
Give me a gut check. Mm-hmm. Is it reasonable? The flood insurance, like most people think of it, if they actually have a claim, or are they going to go bankrupt before they actually get to the place where their claim pays in? Real world, the last 10 years.
Can I speak a little bit to that?
Yeah.
There was, I think you need to step back on the bigger, obviously you're dealing with the federal government, go back to bigger and go back to the two names that you were probably synonymous with, Katrina and Sandy. At that point, Congress realized that it is no longer sustainable for FEMA to subsidize the nation that lives in flood-prone areas or continues to live in that. So they mandated that FEMA become solvent, which means that everyone pays their relative risk based on where they live and how they choose to live or the structure that they live in. That was called the Biggert Waters Act. That was a four-year plan. Everybody's rate was going to go up by 25% a year over 4 years until you reached whatever your risk was, whether that's $1 million risk or a $50 risk. Then obviously after that, the economy crashed and there's another one, I can't remember what it's called.
Affordability Act,
which didn't stop that, but delayed it. Now it's a process of 7 to 10 years. So eventually everyone, you live in your house, and if your house is high risk, your rates will continue to go up until you are paying what FEMA determines is your relative risk to.
Where they become solvent.
They have been subsidizing all of America, and obviously have found that those billions of dollars are non-sustainable. And so what it is intent is that you will pay in the risk so that when it does occur for you, whenever it does, because that structure will at some time flood, one home burns on average, your home burns down every 367 years on average. So there's a statistical fact. And the fact is that they want your risk to pay in enough that when you do, because it's just an insurance, maybe it never pays for you, maybe it does pay for you, and so that you pay your risk.
So So I appreciate that. And I'm just going to wrap up my comments by saying I'm mumbling over here. It's under my breath and complaining. Katrina is my clock. Mm-hmm. That's when FEMA said, we've got to kick it in, boys. And there's a huge brush across the country that basically affected everybody, including mm-hmm. people in Arizona and high desert, mm-hmm. that said, okay, everybody's going to start chipping in to the FEMA insurance program. And we do it with those high-level 10-foot elevation maps that were old-dated stuff from 1988. Hang on.
That's a good point, but it has...
And now we're following through. We follow through on that old map. Coming back to this, the old map, the old data that we took the big paintbrush on, and we're not proving its accuracy, but we're using it as a guideline. That's the piece I keep coming back to. Every city in the land's doing it. We're just saying, oh, yeah, that's a good map, and now we're just following the rules without proving the base information is accurate.
Yeah.
Two things. Okay. One, while we point to things like Katrina and Rita and the big dollars and just the vision of that, when they actually look at this overall, it's a frequency issue. It's not the one-time huge event, which admittedly are happening with greater frequency
right.
than we're seeing across the South in the last year.
It used to be the people along the Mississippi were flooding constantly.
Yeah, but we actually out here, the Pacific Northwest, cost them a lot of money because we're frequency of flooding. So we like to say that it's all about that. It's a little bit more complicated. People don't like that, but it's a little bit more complicated. But to bring us back to this issue of the crawl space and some of the code changes that they're recommending, this actually helps people in North Bend because they have new rating under this actual risk rating. As more and more people get elevation certificates to see if they can get rid of their flood insurance first with these letter of map amendments, and second, to see if they might be able to save some money using an elevation certificate versus just taking whatever rate they get, you have to have, one of the questions they ask about is are crawl spaces allowed in that community? We have to have that in our code for some of those rates to be available.
Well, why wouldn't we put basements in the code then?
Because basements are just not a good idea. It's a giant swimming pool
well,
under your
we
house.
We already have them.
That they're not letting us get away with.
You may have a non-compliant structure, but it's not technically a basement.
Yeah. So the crawl space is something that actually will help people. I didn't realize it wasn't already in our code, and which is funny because I read the code for fun sometimes. But I guess I know, folks. Okay, I just outed myself as a complete idiot. But
we still love you.
Yeah, it helps people, and they're actually already applying those rates where you're seeing it. North Bend has a better chance, and not everywhere, because if you've ever driven through here, there are places where it goes like this. Okay, so not everybody. But in some cases, those are going to help. And having this explicitly there that says that, yes, we're not freaked out by the crawl space thing, and here are the rules you need to follow, will help people that already have homes here that are getting elevation certificates that may not be one of the ones that lucks out and, you know, they're an inch lower than their neighbor who got a Loma. That can help. So there is a purpose to us getting this in there. Okay.
Thank you for the dialogue.
Yeah, I know.
Mr. McCarty, would you be so kind as to just go over this map that we have up here, the flood insurance rate map, and just explain the colors that we see?
Sure. So everything that you see in color is within the special flood hazard area, so that means you have to have insurance.
No matter what color it is?
Not the SHX. That's this stripe. Green. That's 500 year floodplain. But everything else, though. The blue is the primary floodplain. It's the AE zone. And that's the depth of the flooding is measured by the flood elevations, which is what you see, these red contour lines. Those are flood depth lines. The pink or the salmon color is the floodway. That's where no new structures are allowed, residential or commercial structures. Then we have a couple of special flood zones that are based not on the flood depth elevation, but on the ground elevation is what determines what the flood depth is. So we've got our AO1 zone, which presumes that the flood depth is going to be 1 foot above the ground elevation. AO2, 2 feet above. AO3, 3 feet above.
Okay. Well,
Well, that's very helpful, because then when I'm on page 8 and I'm looking at non-residential construction, and when we're thinking about commercial or industrial buildings, am I going to find those commercial and industrial in the blue area? And I'm looking along North Bend Way where I see blue and I see gray and I see red. So I'm guessing we would have some commercial structures inside the floodway. Is there any guidance, because we can have factories or manufacturing, about hazardous materials and anything of that sort that we should include in this document? So I thought at one point somewhere somebody was going to do some kind of manufacturing where they had some chemicals along North Bend Way. I can't remember what the instance was, but I could only think that we would have to, you know, provide some kind of guidance, or we could think about something that would allow uses that are acceptable in the floodway versus those that we don't want.
Well, first of all, the floodway, we don't allow anything new. No new commercial or floodplain. I don't believe that we do regulate storage of chemicals or whatnot in the floodplain regulations.
It would be development. I mean, obviously, if someone was storing chemicals, it would be development. And under development, we would obviously look at our floodplain regulations, and or how would we address it through our code, you know, if they were storing vehicles or chemicals, if you're talking like a storage yard or something mm-hmm. like that. It would be considered development.
If they did some kind of manufacturing, right, they used chemicals in that process. So do we want to have some acceptable and non-acceptable uses inside the floodplain for industrial is what I'm thinking.
So really we're talking about outdoor storage or storage outside of enclosed habitable spaces. Because if they're interior to the building, that building's either going to be flood-proofed or elevated.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be flood-proofed. It's going to be the reverse bathtub, what you see of Bartels. Basically, Bartels has a 2 foot of freeboard, so it should flood, and there should be 2 foot of concrete wall above that. It's dry inside of Bartels. If everybody puts the floodgates in before they run. But that's the theory. The theory is that bathtub will be dry and all the water will be outside of it. It's about protecting the structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking about the community, and right. If we have an opportunity to say that any hazardous material must be stored inside above the flood elevation, is that a worthy amendment to the code? I asked the commission. Any thoughts?
It would be more if it's redundant, like you were saying, somewhere else.
Well, it's not necessarily redundant, but it could be a hardship. So you've got a number of existing businesses that are likely located in just existing buildings that are not flood-proofed or elevated in the floodplain. Thinking like car repair shops or... And
well, can we classify, you know, motor oil is one thing, but arsenic or ammonia is something different. So can we figure out a classification that would say these are definitely toxic and harmful that we want to say don't belong or should be elevated? Motor oil, gasoline, not so. They're already, oil is part of our environment, right? It's in the ground. I kind of make a distinction. I'm not so concerned with auto shops as what we might get in a manufacturing facility. And I don't know what chemicals are, but I know that there's ones that we probably don't want in a flood. So if you can let us know if there's like an easy classification that we could make that designate some kind of chemicals.
Yeah, there's a definition for hazardous materials that's on the state code.
I mean, I was out on Middle Fork, and I see guys driving trucks with explosive signs on their trucks. So I don't know what all we have in our city, but there's something.
See, I think that we get into, I completely get where you're going with this, trust me. But we get into how do we make a determination of what's too much.
The other challenge is these are development regulations as opposed to use regulations. Right. So that's more about how are you managing your business instead of how are you developing your property.
So you're saying I need to lobby city council for the municipal code?
I'm just trying to think of how this would be implemented. First of all, it would be difficult because then you're getting into, you know,
penalties of...
I'm creating jobs. Somebody to
creating work. I don't know if they'll give us any more people.
Because when we talk about comments, it would be an issue of volume. And my thought is that any business that had the kind of volume that would not dissolve very quickly to a safe and quote-unquote level would be already monitored in some way by a level of state regulation.
Fire code. Fire code will regulate your allowable quantities in certain areas. Otherwise, you have to contain those quantities. And so, and I think the manufacturing that maybe you're looking for maybe would be, maybe not so much in your downtown commercial, would be maybe in your EP1 zones to the extent that you're thinking, which would be out to this side of your,
you know. So it's just a Nintendo area.
Right. So I think the likelihood, you know, otherwise you're in containment areas for explosives and things like that. Basically, they're bomb shelters. You know, you could have some limited uses, but I don't think to the extent that you're going to have a big spill.
So 50-gallon drum of green goo is acceptable as far as we know. Do we know if there's an answer to that, or we need to dig back into it? I'm happy to let it go, but I'm also thinking, oh, wait a minute. We don't know the answer to that. How does that get stopped?
There's different regulations that apply to that. Our gridlock for recharge area regulations has very specific criteria about what you can and can't do in these defined for recharge zones. But that's not necessarily the whole floodplain.
Yeah, so if a guy in EP1 opens up a nickel plating business, he's got to get a permit for that. And we're going to find out about
that. Yeah, even in an existing building, you're going to have a business license and things like that. And then we've amended the fire code for certain explosives. Like, you'll never have a rocket building facility in North Bend. It's not permitted. We've amended the fire code, so you can't come here and build rockets. You know, so there are different things, and I think there's different regulations. I'm not saying that there's not the potential that you couldn't have a couple of barrels with some green goo in them floating around in the event of a flood. That could happen. I don't know what the potential of that is based on all the other types of regulations we have and the limited uses that we do from land use regulations and explosives and so on and so forth.
I'll take it as my own action item to research, and then if I want to propose something, we can discuss it at the next meeting.
Cool.
Anything else for page 8?
Page 9?
Ms. Gildersleeve.
So, I know, I'm looking at the time, so I can keep my mouth so, B2. There's something explicitly called out here to notify applicants that flood insurance premiums will be based upon rates that are 1 foot above the floodproof level. There are actually additional requirements and restrictions that can affect that. So even if they, my concern is calling it out explicitly that way, but not adding the additional requirement that they must have a plan in place. So all they can floodproof to the appropriate level and then not receive any benefit on their premium if they haven't done the second part. And there's actually about 3 or 4 things that have to be done in addition to this.
Could you email that to me?
I'm trying to bring it to you, and the FEMA website was on the property with me.
And I think that maybe that language probably comes out of the model language, and it's just something that we haven't added in the additional language.
Because you mentioned if they put all the gates in place,
right.
there are some additional requirements now in order to affect your premium, even if you do the work.
And that is a requirement. Bartels was written by Bartels. I actually, with the help of Tom Stroff, drafted the one for the VIC, and it lists individuals like Jenna and Mark Cray. I mean, not individuals, but those departments, that there's a maintenance and operation schedule, and they do have to submit that as part of their floodproofing certification. And we do require them to do that, and we do have those on file.
And that has to impact. They also have to have a written certification from an engineer. Now.
Yep.
So I'll give you the specific cut piece.
Yeah.
I would hate for someone to come back and say, hey, except that if I did this, it would help my premium. Yep. And it's like, but you didn't do X, Y, and Z too.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of criteria for floodproofing
that
people don't realize.
Yeah.
was my comment on that page.
Excellent. Anything further?
No.
Anyone else? Page 9. Page 10. I just have a question on our sanitary sewer system components. Will our fixes and updates to our sewer plant elevate us in any way, I guess? Or,
you mean that will the building components have to be elevated?
The new tanks or the existing tanks, are they thinking about raising them up, or no, they don't need to be? They're high enough above flood levels?
I can actually speak to that. Spoken to Don DeBerg. If in the sewer plant system they have an existing clarifier, which we now determine that that has a structural issue, so there will be a new clarifier building built. And between Don DeBerg and myself and an engineer, we have had those discussions with the city administrator and the mayor about that new building, because it will be a new building, needs to be built to the standard. So that has been calculated into that new structure. So new structures, yes. Something that would be substantially improved based on that value of that structure, yes, they would have to address that. But there's unlikely that we'll have any structures that will be substantially improved than the existing. And those tanks and different things are exempt from those. Spillage is spillage, and you just deal with the ecology portion of it when it happens. So, yeah. So there is things in the works for the new buildings to be addressed.
So I guess along Jim's point, overall the discussion of this document is more insurance-focused, and I keep coming at it from the community point of view and the homeowner point of view. Mm-hmm. So at what point does that pivot? Like, it's great that the insurance and FEMA is driving that point of view, but I want to think about it from the health of our city and our residents. And
yep.
I guess I kind of ask you guys to think about that as we come back for our next meeting when we discuss that.
I would just say, as you talk about that, go back to that a federal regulation and then the voluntary participation of the CRS program, which is these are the higher regulatory standards that we must adopt to stay in that program, which is voluntary. The city voluntarily does that with the benefit of the return of $200,000 to the community of the people that are affected. The city doesn't gain any benefit by doing that for the community. Just keep that in mind when you're thinking of these regulations, because when you change these regulations, you must give them back to FEMA and give them back to CRS to approve and ecology, and they look at them and they say yes or no.
Sure. I would think, as long as we're thinking in the health of in any event and we're mindful of that, that we would be making some
right.
Good recommendations. And I appreciate that it's a service to the city, but I also think that the residents make the city.
So. Right.
And I would say this, too. I don't see it as a benefit on the first level. The first level of it is, pardon the term, it's coercion. The feds have said, if you want to get a loan, the city wants grant money, get this done.
Right.
It's not helping anybody directly. That's the piece I'm going to rub in about the whole time as an individual property owner. It's kind of like, hang on, I'm fine. I've been working all day long. The big swath federal decision to help everybody, that's great. The next level, they use data that was 20, 30 years old. That's not so great. And then trickle right down through us, small level, to the individual property owner, who now, when Bob Smith wants to remodel his house, he's got to spend $2,000 on experts and permits just because he's got to get flood insurance, which only covers about half of what he might possibly lose in the next 100 years.
And I will tell you that in the past, I have faced some of that same frustration, in that FEMA will come in during a rate match study and they'll bring a lot of experts and talk a lot of high-level stuff, and they'll talk to you, and then the federal government will leave. And then your staff, your city staff, is here left to answer the questions. And the people come in frustrated and all that. And I hope that by my interaction with you, you see that I've gone through that frustration and I really understand, even though I don't live in a floodplain. And I'll tell you, I don't live in a floodplain. I don't own a house in a floodplain. There's a reason.
Sure.
So, but it's really about communicating with your community and really when they come in and you say there's a regulation, instantly the reaction is, and it's really about explaining, and they may not walk away with that they're happy with it, but at least they walk away that, that somebody was able to explain it to them and they were heard and they understand why. They may not like why, but at least I hope that they go away understanding why. And that's the way that I always try and work at it. It is a regulation that we do have to follow, but I hope they feel that they've got the valuable information that they've come to see.
I appreciate very much what you said to me.
So if we want to bring this around, you're talking about what is the benefit to the homeowner? They're paying less. We might not be able to do anything about the fact that they have a flood insurance requirement because they have a loan, but they're paying less because of this kind of thing.
They're paying less after they don't have a choice to pay something.
But what can we affect? We can affect this, we can affect this piece.
And I would say the little old lady that may lived in her house for a long time, that she goes to sell, that the young family comes in, that's the home they can afford. And it's in the floodplain, and it's older, and they're going to pay flood insurance because of these regulations, because of as people knew to build, those people will be able to afford that home because they can afford that mortgage because the insurance is down because of this regulation and what we do citywide.
And when it floods and the green goo comes, then they have a different claim. And they can get rich and move into a big house.
If that story was true, you'd see that all over the news. How FEMA was doing such a wonderful job.
We have approximately 10 pages left, and it's 9:30 in the evening. I'd like to ask the commission if you'd like to pause and come back, or if you'd like to continue on. And I am fine either way, if you all want to tell me your thoughts.
I'm going to step out with no offense to anyone.
I really don't have much after that. So, if you guys don't, I will keep going. Anything on 11 or 12? Mr. Ryan's waiting until I get to the definitions.
I've already had my piece to say.
All right. Page 13 or 14? Anything on the definitions? I will point out on page 3 of the definitions, concentrated animal feeding operation is there. They talk about 1,000 cattle or 700 dairy cows, and if that's their concern level, then I'll say that I don't see that as potential in our city. Could I ask staff in our definitions to include CARA 1 and 2? Because we mentioned that in our documents. And we should have a definition.
I believe those are defined in a separate chapter of our code. Yeah, we have, that's under 14.
You added, we do have critical aquifer recharge area, and you refer to the code. Is that sufficient then, because you have restated it twice on page 3 of the definitions?
So the categories are provided more specifically in the chapter on critical aquifer recharge areas.
Just something I always have to look up. Fine. Okay. Page 4 or 5?
Good.
6?
Good.
7? I notice on lowest floor under on page 7 that it talks about parking facilities are not considered the base level. And I don't remember if in our HDR code or if we have it anywhere that we talk about, you know, multi-unit buildings putting parking on the first level as a, you know, way to just keep their residents safer. And maybe if we, you know, think about, I don't know where in the flood regulations that goes, but...
I don't think we don't address it currently, just in that if you have parking on the in a garage, then it needs to be vented.
Well, this is saying lowest floor under their consideration, and lowest floor does not include an area solely for parking of vehicles. So I'm thinking if you were to build, you know, like the Phoenix Plaza is being talked about, if they had parking on the bottom level, then wouldn't that make it better for the residents insurance-wise?
You're talking about elevated parking?
No. It says the lowest floor, and it would be the ground floor, is for parking of vehicles. Mm-hmm. And then two stories above, you have...
That's the way Phoenix Plaza is designed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just not... What this is talking about means the enclosed area, areas that's not vented for flooding.
Which would be your garage or your crawl space or areas below the BFV, which is lowest floor. Because in your flood insurance survey...
That's not considered a floor.
Right. They say lowest floor, which technically can be your crawl space or your garage if you had a slab on grade.
It's all in definitions.
It is a frustrating code. Yes.
Okay. Page 8. 9. I'm sorry, could you say that again?
I'm looking at the
moderate intensity.
Moderate intensity of land.
Okay.
Moderate intensity of land is defined here as with a residential unit of 1. And it ends with the term or less. So you'd have, if you had 1 unit or less, it's moderate. I would think that if you had less, it'd be low intensity.
Well, I don't know how you have less than 1.
Until you reach that definition of low intensity. But that talks about not residential, but parks and undeveloped open space.
Okay, if I was looking at the definition of the term, and it just says residential. 1 unit or less, it seems like you have no units.
Yeah, why does it have to say less?
Well, if you're at 1 unit for 5 acres, that's still considered moderate intensity because it's not what would meet the definition of low intensity, which is not residential uses.
Well, I think if you further read in there, which moderate uses would include land uses such as orchards and hayfields, where if you go to low intensity, it's really intended to be undeveloped land on the previous page. Low intensity, about middle of the page. Limited to forestry and open space such as passive recreation and natural resources.
On
so that's how you get to low intensity. Otherwise, from a house to an orchard, you're in moderate intensity.
I think the definition has to stand on its own. You can't connect it to one on some other page. It just cares of intensity. Just use the word intensity to have moderate. There was no development on the property, seems to be.
If there's no development on the property, it would probably fit under the low intensity definition.
Yeah.
Right.
And so but it's defined as 1 unit or less. Why just take out the less?
Because then anything less than 1 unit per acre would presumably default to low intensity, but that's not the intent here.
The key is the per acre. So 1 unit per acre or per 2 acres or 3 acres or 4 acres.
So instead of saying less, can we say that? I'm with Dick. I'm not getting if it's 1 unit per acre or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. I'm following like 1 or less.
How about residential uses up to a density of one per acre?
Yeah, that's just that's the same thing, but it's just the reverse of it. Basically, you could have one house on 5 acres. That's the only thing you do. It would be considered a low density. It wouldn't be considered moderate because it's less than.
So you're striking more or less?
Yeah.
So residential at a density of one unit per acre?
No. Residential at a density, or residential up to a density of one unit per acre.
Yes.
Okay, so after the comma, residential, insert up to, strike at a density of one unit per acre, strike or less. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Anything further on page 8? Page 9.
Paragraph on the term riparian habitat. It seems to me that we're leaving out lakes. The riparian habitat is defined as parallel to a boiling water. Certainly, if we have riparian habitat around still water.
Well, it's talking about flowing water, so there's probably an equivalent for lakes and wetlands.
But the definition of riparian habitat is not talking about flowing water. It says
riparian, I think, generally refers to rivers and streams. Mm-hmm.
But we've defined it as being only flowing water. It seems to me we should be saying including lakes and flowing water.
I believe these are probably from the state in regard to critical areas.
Yeah, I think it comes I think that comes right out of the WAC. I think that's the WAC definition.
Well, lake is separately defined, so there's a definition for lake. So.
This is not a definition of lake, it's a definition of riparian habitat.
Right.
So we should be having all habitats that are have riparian.
But I think
flowing water, swamps, lakes, whatever.
I think the context of riparian though refers to river or stream.
Yeah, I think so. You'd have to say wetland habitat or lake habitat.
Right, and so I would say, I don't know if you can see this, where the definition is for riparian habitat, not the, what is a rock, a lake, or a stream. It's what is a riparian habitat, and I'm saying a riparian habitat exists when it's in the, when it's in or around water.
That could be.
Commissioner Ryan, I'm going to disagree with you. According to Wikipedia, it is flowing water.
What the hell is Wikipedia?
Let's not use Wikipedia ever. Except for looking at
the differences. I can write a definition of Wikipedia and they take it.
I mean,
it came out of this box.
That definition, if I'm not mistaken, comes right out of the WAC, and they break it down, and then at the end they do define what a wetland is, and a water type, water resource inventory, and then previously, like Mike said, they do define what a lake is.
For our purposes in North Bend, at least, we don't have any lakes, so we're not going to have to worry about whether or not it would include a lake or not.
That's also consistent with the USDA.
Thank you.
Okay.
Natural Resources Conservation Service.
If I can't make myself understood on this, I'm wondering what the hell I'm doing sitting here at this table. We're trying to define riparian habitat, and we're only defining part of it. If that's the way all these definitions are, this is pretty shabby work.
Well, keep in mind, these are all existing definitions. This is not something that we're editing. We're not changing riparian habitat. That's just... We gave you the whole code section and showed you in redline format what's changing. Those are existing definitions out of our critical area regulations.
I think it should be amended. If You're showing amendments in this, but I'm thinking as of this right now, I think if this is not being amended, it should be.
Let me come back to you with more information on riparian habitat, where that definition comes from. I don't want to amend it if that's going to then conflict with other provisions of the code or the state code that this is.
We're not citing the state code in this anywhere, are we?
Yeah. The floodplain regulations need to be consistent with state floodplain requirements. Likewise, our critical area regulations need to be consistent with state critical area requirements.
And then wetlands defined by the RCW. And then there, we referenced some WACs in the back. But some different WACs, but yeah.
Okay, page 10. We're almost there, guys. Page 11.
11?
Yes, sir.
Copy?
Yes.
I believe the word above, right before the number 25, I think it should be below 25 feet. When you're topping something, you begin from the top and you go down. This would say that you're topping from the first wall of trees up 25 feet. Now, you're cutting the tree down to do that. Topping would be coming vertically downward.
25% of the vegetation height? Is that what you're reading?
That's what I'm saying. 25% of vegetation height. You would start cutting from at the top and going below.
I think that's saying the same thing. So you've got your tree and the vegetation, anything that's above 25% of that level would be considered topping.
I'll agree.
Why is it so low? I guess that's my question.
That does seem strangely low.
It sounds like it is cutting the whole thing down.
If you have a 100-foot tree and you're only concerned about the first 25, that's more than topping. Is that what you're saying?
Two-thirds of a tree.
Interesting.
Do you feel 50%, 75%?
No, I'm getting done with this, guys.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. If this is not the regular changes.
Mike, is that something you can look into and see?
We
should at least have it at 50 or 75, I would think.
I'll look into that.
Okay. On 11 also, understory. It means vegetation layer of a forest that includes shrubs, herbs, grasses, and grass-like plants, but excludes trees. Well, that's can't be right. An understory is the top or the crown of a vegetated tract. I don't call it a timber tract, but anything below that is understory. That includes trees, undersized trees, trees that will never grow to the top of the top of the crown. That's understory. Anything that's living below the crown is understory.
Like saplings.
Yeah, I think the intent there is it's excluding the canopy, the big trees.
Yeah.
But I agree with you that small trees are part of the understory.
Any vegetation under there. And I think the idea here is that the author of this definition wanted to make sure that if there's going to be any vegetation removed, that they would not remove the trees. So it can't, it's understory, it's potentially removable. But it's another, again, it's the definition that's trying to finesse it. Technically, it's everything under the crown is an understory.
This, again, comes back to the context of not knowing where this is used. So I need to see where understory is a part of a regulation. And then I can get and understand the context more of how we maybe would better define it.
Anything on page 12? And then there's a page of five pages? Mm-hmm. Floodplain regulation updates with just some small changes. Any questions or changes about those?
Going back, I guess, to the staff report, there was just something towards the end of the summary findings, and I've seen this on other, the RV section, where I guess reviews of the Planning Commission is not conducted yet are listed as being reviewed.
What finding are you on?
Like, just number one. And this is the same on the RV. It says the Planning Commission reviewed the draft amendments at their September 8th meeting, which is today.
Yeah.
Then mm-hmm. September 22nd and October 13th.
What I'm doing is I've prepared this so that when you make your final recommendation, it'll be ready to go. You will be reviewing those at your next meeting.
Likely, but it's something that happens. I mean,
That happens, then I'll change the staff report to reflect that.
I mean, as you're putting other things in yellow, I mean, with that. Be good to put those things that
I can might do that.
Happen. Just or because it, this is a form of record.
So or just put it as not final or draft or something to that effect.
I think it's a safer business practice.
Okay.
I appreciate it because it gives me a chance to noodle on what might be in our report and put anything in there that I feel is different.
Okay.
But yeah, I agree with you. Okay.
I didn't bring that up. I don't want people to be arguing with
You may have addressed most of them, but I do plan to come back on the 22nd in case there's any additional questions.
Awesome.
Just in case.
So yeah, and
thanks for your time.
Thanks. We'll also have Christina Bowman, who's our floodplain manager consultant.
You spare
available by telephone.
Yeah, I have her telephone.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming and answering all our questions. I really appreciate that and giving us a chance to grill you a bit. Planning Commission, go to the order.
As much as we want to go, question compliments of my 12-year-old nephew who just noticed the boat and the life preserver at the sewer plant, apparently, as they drove by, and he asked, why is there a life preserver and a boat over by the sewer plant. Do we even know?
Presumably, if somebody falls into one of those nasty tanks.
We would assume. You got to get them out. I don't know. That would be a theory, but.
Okay. They were doing lots of tours. What's next for our next meeting is going to be RV parks and flood?
Yeah.
Okay. I know at our last meeting, I want to thank Elizabeth for chairing and for bringing up my comments. I'm going to ask the commission to receive an email that I'll send to staff with a link to FireWise pamphlet. What I was specifically wanting to address was fire safety zones, which were in the first 30 feet. And so I think it didn't get communicated in my notes correctly, and I wasn't here to elaborate on that. So I hope when we have somebody from the fire department here, we can not only know what is recommended for FireWise, and which is not just a King County program, but it's a national program. And that way we can be better versed and have some good questions about what to put in our regulations. So, other than that, motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second? We have a motion by Commissioner Heller and a second by Commissioner Miller. All those in favor of adjourning say aye.
Aye.
Commission is adjourned at 9:56. Thank you all for your wonderful input.
As you're thinking about fire safety.